Logan, I'd like you to meet Aurora Monroe, also called Storm. This is Scott Summers, also called Cyclops.
What do they call you? Wheels?
You're in my school for the gifted, for mutants. You'll be safe here from Magneto.
What's a Magneto?
A very powerful mutant. He believes that a war is brewing between mutants and the rest of humanity. I've been following his activities for some time.
Welcome, everyone. This is episode 18 of the Comics in Motion podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Phelps. My co-host is Mr. Dave Horrocks.
Welcome, everyone, to the Comics in Motion podcast. What we like to do here is we like to review media like movies, TV shows and games that are based on comic books. Myself, I'll be reviewing the media from the perspective of a longtime comic book fan. And my co-host Chris will be reviewing the media mainly from that media perspective only and without that comic book baggage. Chris, it's close to New York, isn't it?
So yeah, it is, Dave. I'm off to New York this week, FOC or free of charge to everyone out there. I don't know what to expect because I've never been. Obviously, I've only ever been to America, Las Vegas side. So this is, I'm really, really looking forward to it. And to coincide with it, Dave, I've been doing a vlog, which I've just completed the first part of the last couple of days.
Very good. I must admit, I did watch it. So I have seen it. I thought the editing was quite good. I got to see a little bit more of Lan Dudno than I thought I was going to see. A little bit more of the Fruities than I thought I was going to see. But no, it was very good. Very impressed.
Well, Dave, one thing out of the vlog that's been gone viral, and this is through some of the YouTubers and my family who pointed out first, is I interviewed my mother, and there's a pair of my brother's undies over her left shoulder, which I got told off by my brother's wife.
Really?
Yeah, well, brother's missus, because they've actually become more popular than the vlog at the moment. But I suppose it's something.
I must admit, I didn't see that. Were Spider-Man undies or anything, were they?
No, they were just great ones. They weren't the best. But no, it's a good learning curve. And I think as well, for what we do, is if we do go to the comic cons and things like that, then it will, well, we will be going to them. I will do a vlog while I'm there. I'm sure you will. It's just learning as you go, and I've learned this week, and I've had some good help off yourself and various other vloggers on YouTube who I've interviewed on the podcast. So great, really good. And I promise that the second part we will actually have bits of New York in, Dave. It was a bit of a behind the curtain sort of job, this one, just to sort of familiarize myself with how to do it, and people know who I am, and my family are going to be on it a lot anyway, whichever vlog I do. So
yeah,
wherever I'm going. So yeah, no, thanks for asking. It's been really good.
I did like your line about your brother does look quite like the guy off Guess Who.
Yeah, he does, Richard. Everyone said that, Dave. Everybody.
I did have me chuckling genuinely out loud. He's a good sport about it. He just sort of rolled with it. I guess it's probably not the first time he's heard it.
No, Dave, I couldn't have put half the stuff he was saying about me, because we all take it on the chin in our family. If it's, well, we have to do the size of our noses, because it's usually the measuring of the noses that starts, and I've got the biggest one in the family. So that's usually where I get the abuse. But luckily, that was edited out of my own vlog. Conveniently. So, but no, it was good. And thanks for watching as well, Dave. It was good.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been to New York a few times. I think you'll love it. It's obviously, Vegas is a weird place, even for America. So it's not really like Vegas, but it is really good. And it's a lot more, if you went a little bit further out west, it's a bit more chilled out. It's a bit more highly strung over on that East Coast side. But I think you'll love it.
Oh, I can't wait. And the first thing I'm going to do, Dave, is eat a lot of pizza and burgers.
I was going to say, so, I mean, they are quite proud of their pizza there. Yeah. They claim that it's the water. You know, that they make the dough with that gives this New York pizza its special sort of flavor. I'm not sure I buy that too much, but you know, they're very proud of it. I mean, things I do, I mean, there's just a ton. Obviously, historically, there's a lot of Irish over there, so there's tons of Irish bars, little Irish bars, and you can see all the, you know, they've got 20 TV screens at the bar and stuff, so you can watch whatever the sport is this at the moment. I'm not quite up on my American sports, but when you're there, you kind of end up getting sucked into it.
Yeah, you do. You're right.
And no, it's really good. And I'm sure you'll have a big itinerary, won't you? Work will have sorted you out with stuff to do. But if I could recommend anywhere, get yourself down to Midtown Comics. That's quite a famous.
Yes, I know that.
Yeah, a famous comic shop there. So I'd be impressed if I saw a little vlog entry that was in there. Maybe interview some of the people who work there. Maybe some of the patrons. I'm sure they'd love it.
You're probably under pressing out, Dave.
You know what? And I tell you, the very first time I went when I was a kid, and it was a very different New York then.
Yeah.
It's really quite safe now. But the first time I went as an adult, it was with work, and it was just literally changing over at JFK. And it was February, so there was loads and loads of snow. And so my colleague who I was traveling with was a smoker. So we had something like a 5-hour stopover. It was a bit daft, really. I didn't look at the map and see Boston's not really that far if we decided to drive. But we had to wait for about 5 hours in JFK, and he needed to get out to have a cigarette. And so anyway, there's nothing else for me to do. We got 5 hours there. So I just joined him. Not for a cigarette, but just to stand outside, get a bit of the cold sort of fresh air and stand in the snow. And where we kind of went out, they had like the, what are they called? The guy, you know, when you have like taxis and stuff, or limos and stuff, you get a guy like an usher who just opens the door and what have you. There's one of those stood there, but there's no cars rolling up or anything. So, you know, when you go abroad, you go into English and British overdrive. You know, you just feel a lot more English and British there. And so just trying to make polite conversation with this bloke. And a colleague there, he goes, it's cold here, isn't it? Is it this cold up in Boston? You know, not really knowing the map and the fact that it's further north, so even colder. The guy just looks at him like he wants to stick a knife in him with utter disdain. And he just goes, Boston? What the hell do I know about Boston? I'm from New York.
That's a good accent, man. So
he just quickly, he'd only just lighted up this cigarette, and he just sort of puts it out on his under his foot there, and he's like, right, should we get back inside then? So that was the first introduction to some of the New York manners there. They don't suffer fools gladly.
No, sorry to segue off now, Dave, yep. Obviously, but I've got a similar story when I went to Vegas, and if you can indulge me on this quickly. We and Sam had just gone to Vegas 2012, never been to America. I'm a big tipper in the UK. Like, I'll always tip the staff because I know they get treated like dirt in like restaurants and things like that. And I'm always polite, and I really go out of my way because I feel the pain, how horrible and ignorant people can be towards them, and, you know, treat them like someone they stood on most of the time. So being from the UK, you're used to carrying your bags, aren't you? So what we pull up in the taxi, and I tip the taxi driver. I get the cases. I was like, I'll get them. I said, no, I'll get them. Didn't think anything of it. Sorry, the cab, should I say. And I've got Sam's case, and I'm carrying both of them under both up my her case and mine. And I walk into like the main entrance of the MGM, and we've got all these bellboys there, and there's a guy there looks like Stone Cold Steve Austin, a big American goatee. You know, he was taller than me. I mean, I'm 6'2". He was about 6'4". He's a big, imposing bloke, big suit on, but he's overcoat. He must have been sweltering because it was warm. But he just looked like, you know, like a doorman sort of thing. But he's the main guy. And he's like, you know, good afternoon, sir, madam. You know, would you like to take your cases? And I went, no, it's fine. Thank you. I'm okay. I'll take it myself. Well, Dave, not realizing that's his job and that's what they get paid off. And I felt terrible. He literally was going to clothesline me there and then. And Sam went, that guy changed from being the nicest person in the world to I'd literally stolen money out of his children's mouth. Oh, I felt terrible. Yeah. But again, me and you are from the north. So we're not, I mean, Americans see the typical English as these posh people from like, you know,
Harry Potter.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Oh, yes, we'll have tea. Because when you see people and I play on the Xbox, they always say, oh, you're from the UK. Oh, tea and crumpets with the Queen. Or I went to Vegas and a couple said, say hello to the Queen. And this guy went, that's like them telling you to say hello to Oprah. You know, it's just, we're 200 miles away, and we're normal English people. They're like a parody, aren't they, of the English way.
I must admit, I have been asked before, do you know the Beatles?
Yeah. You're pretty close to the Beatles, aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, I am. I'm only half an hour away. But again, it's that parody of, and that sort of stereotype in English is teen crumpets and we play polo and ride horses, you know, and all that. And we don't speak like that, you know, but again, to sort of tie it with what you said, he was just like, oh no, he really was going to do me some damage, Dave. I thought, I'm going to get a good kick in it. And I didn't. I was doing it out of being polite, thinking, oh, I'll save your job. And I still tipped the lad, but he was just like, he was absolutely dingy with me. And I was like, oh no, I won't be doing that again. So every time I was tipping him. Oh yeah, there you go. You know, but anyway, sorry, I went off on one then.
It's a fine art over there as well. You know, even if you've had terrible service, I can't remember what it is now. Is it something like 14%? If you've had absolutely awful service, you still have to tip something like 14%. I can't remember what. I always refresh myself before I go over there again. But it's not because over here it's more an optional thing, isn't it?
Yes,
especially with the. Minimum wage and whatever. I mean, they have minimum wage over there, but it's not really a living wage.
Yeah.
And it's just part of the culture there. So it is something you want to refresh yourself on before you go over there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when we do this sort of podcast next week or whatever, you'll be saying to me, so Chris, I can see you've got a black eye. There you go.
You know, in the story I was telling you about before, it was a bit concerned about getting more than a black eye, you know, reaching for his holster or something, you know, but yeah, no, I'm sure you'll love it. But like I say, so some of the New Yorkers can be a little bit abrupt.
Yeah. And I think it's just it's the way their personality, isn't it? They're very to the point, which I like, to be fair. Yeah. I'd prefer someone to be straight down the line with me. So yeah. Anyway, Dave, just sort of going on to last week's review, me and you are at a bit of a crossroads, and my two friends who went to watch Solo, as we wrap it up, because the reviews I've seen online have been not what we've finished up with the review on. Even questions on Twitter off the fans and the followers of the podcast have asked the same thing, saying it's a great film and all this, and I still don't get it.
Yeah, I've seen various reviews. I think I've probably seen more positive reviews.
Yeah,
then I have negative, which is a bit of a surprise, and I guess it's, you know, it's each to their own, isn't it? After The Last Jedi, I saw a lot of Marmite reviews, so yeah, people who either loved it, people who hated it, and I loved it.
Yeah, me too.
But with this one, I've been a little bit surprised. You know, because like I say, going into our review last week, I was kind of thinking, you know what, this is just middle of the road. It kind of looks nice, you know. I didn't have a terrible time, but you know, it did drag a bit. And by the time the end came, I was like, right, well, I'm glad that's over. But it does. It seems there's a lot of people who kind of loved it out there, and so I can only surmise that. One of the things we talked about last week was, you know, which generation is this for?
Mm.
And so maybe some of those positive reviews are people who maybe haven't been brought up on the original trilogy, and maybe it's the older crowd who don't like it, or maybe there's a different variable than that I'm just not seeing. But I'm a bit confused by it. I really don't think it deserves, in my personal opinion, the plaudits that I've seen from some quarters.
No, and I think you've just hit on a very good point, actually, Dave, because between me, you, and Ace and Mark, who are my two friends who went to watch it with, I mean, I'm 39, but you're going of an age group. I think Mark's 47, 48. So you've got an age group between the four of us of about 7 or 8 years. So, but the other side of 40 is such. And I don't get it. I genuinely... I go on it on purpose. I follow the Star Wars stuff on Facebook again, and everyone's saying, what a great film. It's given me faith back in the Star Wars trilogy after, you know, Disney monopolized it with all these films, like the five or four films in 4 years or whatever it's been. And I still think it's like being in a parallel universe. But I am intrigued. I know I said about Black Panther, and I didn't have the heart to sort of sit through it again after the brilliance of Avengers and Deadpool 2, even though I tried to watch it the other week. This I've got to watch again, and I've got to sit there. And I've said to you before, I will rescind my review score. It may have been because I'd gone at midnight, but I didn't get any feeling or compassion towards any of the characters. So I'm just a mystery, Dave. One of life's mysteries.
It is. I'll watch Solo again, but I can imagine it's probably a lazy Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
Lying on the sofa and it comes on the TV and it's like, all right, Solo, let's give that another go.
Yeah.
But not sort of dip in and out of it, probably do a few chores and whatever in between. I just don't have it in me. And this latest batch of Star Wars films, I think it's hands down the worst of the lot. I thought every other one was pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree, Dev. I think if I did a running order, it'd probably be Rogue One, The Force Awakens, or maybe Force Awakens and Rogue One together, Last Jedi. But I think the best scene of all the films I've seen is the bit with Kylo Ren and Rey in The Last Jedi when they go against Snoke. Mm-hmm. And then this, look, that's what reviews are about, the subjective. We all have different opinions, and that's what makes the world go round. We can't all like the same things, but don't get it. Really don't get it.
So should we move on to this week's movie then?
Let's go, Dave.
So we decided, and it was only a matter of time, that we'd tackle the X-Men franchise. Of course, we've already done the one that everyone likes to try and forget about, which is Generation X. We have kind of started it off. So in theory, this is the second of the Fox X-Men universe, but I think a lot of people consider this to be the first one, quite for obvious reasons.
I'm not saying a word, Dave. Awful film.
Anyway. So I should go through a bit of comics background first then?
Yeah.
Okay, so X-Men debuted in their own comic in 1963, and they were created by that famous team of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. That team had already created the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, although actually the artist was Steve Ditko for Spider-Man, Hulk, Thor by this time. And Stan Lee, he wanted to come up with a team book, but he was not a little bit tired, but he just didn't want to keep having to think, well, how could this person get their powers and how could that person get their powers, you know? And there's quotes from him saying, you know, he couldn't have everyone being bitten by a radioactive spider or being hit by a truck filled with radioactive waste or whatever. So he just came up with the idea that there'd be mutants and they were just born that way. And so from that idea, you know, he started to build up on that. And between Lee and Kirby, they decided, you know, well, there should be a school. So I think the idea of the X-Men came first and then the school. And then, well, if you've got school, you need to have a professor type of character as well. And when Lee first pitched the idea to Martin Goodman, who's the publisher at Marvel, he wanted to call it The Mutants. But Goodman didn't really like it because he thought, well, people wouldn't know what mutants were. So Lee kind of went back and he thought a bit harder and basically thought, well, they have some extra powers and extra abilities. So we'll just call them X-Men. Which, you know, it sounds like it's made up, but I've seen various interviews with Stan Lee where he recounts that. So that's where the whole X something sort of comes from. Now, in that very first comic, the original team was Cyclops, Jean Grey, who was known as Marvel Girl, Iceman, you should go back and have a look at some of the original images. He was more like, he was drawn more like a snowman, and he had these little boots. So when he turned into snow, you know, all his clothes and everything seemed to turn into snow, apart from he had these little boots. It looks a little bit, well, it just looks dated, quite honestly, now. We also had Beast, although it wasn't Blue Furry Beast at that time, and we had Angel as well. And in that very first comic, they come across the villain Magneto. And if you read that old story, he really is just a two-dimensional villain, you know, mustache twirling type of villain there. And a lot of those early comics, it's just typical superhero stories. So you got the goodies and you got the baddies. And it was only later when they started developing on this idea that the mutants were kind of this alienated minority and you had themes of prejudice coming in there. That was built up on over the years. And since then, a lot of parallels have been drawn between Professor X and Magneto and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. You know, so basically fighting for what they believe in, but just in very, very different ways. Now, sales of the X-Men weren't great. They lagged behind the other top issues that they had, other top titles that they had. So at issue 66, they basically stopped writing new material. And issues 67 through to 93 were just reprints of older stories. Now, I don't know if that was typical behavior or trick back then, but kind of feels cheating to me a bit. But I guess it was a different time because, you know, a lot of these comics would hit the newsstands, wouldn't they? And you didn't have comic shops and you certainly didn't have an internet where you could go and order some back issues. So I guess it probably does make some sense there. So it kind of lay dormant for a little while. And then in 1975, they released Giant Size X-Men number one with writer Len Wein and Dave Cockrum. Now, this was a very, very different team. And it was put together to go off and rescue some of the other X-Men there. And the only member of the team that ended up surviving this cull and this complete reboot, if you like, was Cyclops. Now, one of the criticisms was that, you know, this wasn't a very diverse group of people. So they went completely the other way. So they had this really diverse team. So you basically had Colossus, who was Russian. You had Nightcrawler, who was German or West German at the time. You had Storm, who was a Kenyan. You had a Native American Thunderbird in there. You had Japanese Sunfire, Irish Banshee, and Canadian Wolverine. Now, a few of those didn't survive being in the team for very long. Sunfire, Banshee, Thunderbird literally didn't survive for that long. So they were jettisoned out, and after, not too long after, Jean Grey ended up coming back. Now, what also happened, so after that kind of one-off issue came out, Chris Claremont ended up joining on that X-Men title in 1975. And he has been he's had one of the longest runs, probably out of anyone in comics, certainly on a mainstream title. So he wrote the X-Men through that late 70s or mid to late 70s period, right through the 80s, and that only came off in the very early 90s. He took that book and that concept. Remember, it hadn't been selling very well, and basically built it up. He started playing a lot around with the characters and how they interacted, and he wrote some absolutely great stories. Dark Phoenix is probably one of the most famous ones, which is well renowned. But yeah, the X-Men that we know now, really a lot of the development, I think, owes a lot to Chris Claremont's time on it there. Now, in terms of recommended reading, I've mentioned a couple there. So obviously the very early issues, the Giant Size X-Men number one, I think that's well worth reading. But real recommended reading, and it's to do with what happens very early in this movie that we're going to talk about today, is a little mini series called Magneto Testament. Came out in 2009, and it's a 5-issue story. And this is basically Magneto growing up as a young Jewish boy in pre-World War II Germany. And I honestly think something like this should be read in schools, you know, because it's obviously following Magneto and, all right, it's not even really about superheroes. There's a lot of historical facts kind of woven into the story And so it's about him as a boy growing up and just observing what's around him. It's very like, or similar in a way. There's a graphic novel, again, very highly renowned, called Mouse, M-A-U-S. And again, it's about that theme. It's about growing up, being Jewish in Germany, in and around that time, in the kind of mid to late 30s, going into the 40s. Really, really good read. And that Mouse, they basically draw the Jews as mice, and then the Nazis are the cats. Really, really powerful book. But yeah, Magneto Testament, definitely go and pick that up. Really, really good read.
Good stuff, Dave. Good stuff.
So, Chris, what can you tell us about the movie?
Well, like pretty much every movie that I've researched, that we've reviewed, or TV series, it was in development for a long time, even going back to 1984. It was actually looking at doing an X-Men film. James Cameron was on board as one of the executive producers, with Catherine Bigelow as a possible director. Stan Lee had pitched it in 1989-90 with Chris Claremont, as you said. But Dave, I don't think it would have worked, because the original incarnation of Wolverine, he actually had Bob Hoskins down as Wolverine.
I heard this. Now, he would be hairy enough, I think.
Yeah.
It just
not on top
would
of his head.
Work, would it?
No. Yeah. And Angela Bassett, who obviously played Tina Turner, she was going to play Storm. But the deal sort of fell through because Cameron.
That's Black Panther's mum, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah, it's indeed. Until the basket, yeah. It's all interwoven, Dave. But it sort of fell through around the early 90s, because James Cameron was interested in the Spider-Man film, but the studio sort of went into receivership and it all just went to pot, basically. This one's directed by, as we know, Bryan Singer, written by David Hayter. The main stars at the time were Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen, and obviously Halle Berry. Now, it was Hugh Jackman's first Hollywood blockbuster of sorts, and he was a last minute replacement to play Wolverine. They'd already started filming for over 2 to 3 weeks before he actually came in as a replacement. Originally, it was, I don't even remember the actor, Scottish actor Dougree Scott, who was in Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah,
he's been quite a few things afterwards. He's in a cracking film about some like Busby a couple of years ago, and he was down to do and play the part of Wolverine, but got injured in one of the bike scenes in Mission Impossible 2. So he couldn't do it. And with the conflicts of filming that, so it all sort of interwoven. And then it was actually Russell Crowe who suggested Hugh Jackman, because they wanted Russell Crowe to play Wolverine. But after the sort of success of Gladiator, he was just phenomenal. One, his stock had risen and he couldn't do it. So he suggested him. He was a good friend of his. And that's where, you know, everyone knows Wolverine as Hugh Jackman 18 years later, but at the time he was literally a nobody. He was someone, I've read this myself, he was actually a PE teacher in the UK. He used to work on doing the schools in the daytime, and then at night he would tread the boards on the West End and in theatre and that. So really good pitch of it. And then obviously tying in with Solo last week, we've got Ray Park in the film, which I do think Ray Park being in this film elevated a lot of the martial arts and fighting stuff, because you can see his stamp on some of the scenes with Wolverine and Rogue and things like that. It is stepped up a level in this, even though it's 18 years ago. You can see that sort of Blade influence on there as well. But
Mystique, probably more so than Rogue.
Sorry, yeah.
I don't remember Anna Paquin doing those jumping spinning kicks.
Okay, that was the edited DVD version that we've got, yeah.
All right. That was the Rogue cut. Yeah, the Rogue cut. The original X-Men. Right. Got it.
Terrible. They started production of it and filming around the end of 99 and finished around March 2000, but it was all done in Canada, in Toronto. They'd use the house again was used, was the same one that we've seen in Generation X and Deadpool. Well, the outside was anyway. Due to the budget, they had a budget of $75 million. And in the original screenplay that was sort of written around about 96, they did actually have Beast and Nightcrawler in the film, but they actually cut them from the final sort of pre-production. Critically, brilliant, Dave. It's 81% overall Rotten Tomatoes, and it was the real sort of catalyst of the superhero films. Fox had put a lot of money into this, hoping that it had re-emerge after the success of Blade, and it did. And obviously from that we got, you know, X-Men 2, we even had the Hulk Eric Banner one. I know it doesn't get a great response from people. I actually quite liked it, to be fair, but it's one of these things where this again tipped on the edge 18 years ago. Look where we are now. The whole Marvel and stuff. I know this is these are Fox-based films, but there wouldn't be Avengers and things like that. They wouldn't have the confidence to do if it wasn't for this film. And it was a total financial success as well. It made nearly $300 million, as I say, off the budget $75 million. So they were always going to make a second, and everything they did from this was gold, really, with the X-Men. Whether critically it was any good or not, financially they just made money, and it just made everything about Hugh Jackman was Wolverine. So really good, really good. One thing I would say regarding Wolverine, obviously we mentioned Bob Hoskins, and again, it's a who's who they originally sort of auditioned for the part. We've got Keanu Reeves, Mel Gibson, Aaron Eckhart, Van Damme. Now, Van Damme might be good on the actual fighting scenes, but not any of the acting, I don't think. Edward Norton, Viggo Mortensen from Lord of the Rings. Obviously, we've got Sir Ian McKellen was Magneto, which I must say, Dave, Magneto's one of my favourite characters in these X-Men franchises. Absolutely love him, whether it's him or Michael Fassbender. I just love his character. Like you said, he is two-dimensional, but I just think he's brilliant. He's just so maniacal.
Well, I mean, not to derail you, so in that very first issue, he was just a two-dimensional villain.
Yeah.
Magneto is absolutely my favorite villain character. And I kind of use villain in speech marks, because they say, don't they, the villains, typically, the best villains are a hero in their own story.
Yeah.
And Magneto absolutely is. And when you see his background, you can kind of get behind it. And actually, Magneto's been on and off the X-Men team various times. And there was a mini-series, a Secret Wars mini-series around the mid-80s, where, I mean, it was a bit of a... I think the original intent was just get all of your top characters in a big story so you can release a load of toys. I think that was the original idea behind it. But I quite like the story, because they basically put all their top heroes onto a planet along with a load of the top villains. And because this other chap, this other worldly being, basically plucked out these characters and set them against each other, he ended up putting Magneto on the hero's side.
Yeah.
And I thought, brilliant. You know, so this space being, I think it was the Beyonder, basically got confused because he saw the actions of Magneto and mistook him for a hero. And I just think he's absolutely brilliant. And I agree. I think Ian McKellen, brilliant as Magneto. And I really like the younger version of Magneto as well, with Michael Fassbender.
Yeah, exactly. But what I was going to mention, Dave, was they've got Magneto. Totally agree. And we'll get into that, obviously, as we do the review. But Christopher Lee was up. But Dave, another one of our legends, Mr. Terrence Stamp, was actually up there.
Yeah, I saw that.
It would have been Neil. So I'm happy with that. I'm lucky on him. But I think McKellen makes it his own.
I agree. And I don't think, you know, he's a massive star now. Again, I think it was a transformational movie for him, or transformational role for him as well. I don't think he was that well known. He'd worked with Patrick Stewart years before at the Shakespeare Company, I believe, but, you know, hadn't really had too many huge roles.
No, and you know, fair play to him. And reading some of the stuff I've read, he's obviously, Sir Ian McKellen's openly gay, and he says about the prejudice that he'd had over the years. So it shows, really, that, you know, Hollywood started to wise up and actually, you know, realizing how stupid they'd been with this sort of macho image of people playing roles. Mm-hmm. And he's a gay rights activist, and fair plays. It was brilliant, absolutely brilliant, and total respect for him to, you know, playing the role as he does, because I just think he's great. Absolutely brilliant actor. Absolutely. Yeah. And he's a great foil for Patrick Stewart. Really, he's a great foil.
Yeah, I think they handle their relationship quite well. We'll get into the review, I'm sure. I don't think they completely nail his character, and I'll talk about why I think that later on. But I really like some of the things they did with their relationship.
Yeah, yeah. So are we? That's all the film stuff I've got, Dave. Are we going to jump into the review?
Yeah, just before we do that, just another thing on the movie. I believe Bryan Singer turned down the role to direct this movie several times before he eventually agreed, and that was because I think he'd watched the 92 animated series.
Oh, right, okay.
And that kind of turned his mind around on it, you know, and saw some of the issues were very real. You know, again, if you're not that familiar with the X-Men and the stories and a lot of the subtext to it,
yep,
then, you know, from the outside, it can all look a bit silly, kind of silly costumes and heroes fighting villains. But when you get deeper into it, there's a lot of real issues that are touched on there in the storytelling.
No, I agree. And I must admit, Dave, as a cartoon fan, the X-Men run 92, which was on in the UK, probably around about pretty much the same time or within a year, I loved them. Absolutely loved him. So yeah, that's one of the reasons I actually got into X-Men, because with not having any comic background, I just used to watch it on a Saturday morning, Wolverine and everything. And he's one of them characters that, I'll be honest with you, I think we're both singing from the same hymn sheet here. He's Wolverine. He's actually up there with probably Superman as one of my favourite characters, and Batman. So I'll be honest, I'm from a totally biased perspective on this, because I absolutely love that raging, like I do with Incredible Hulk, I love that raging lunatic that he is. I don't know why, but it's not as if it's in my personality to be like that, but I do. And I think they nail him, other than his height, they nail him in all these films.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure, I don't think we have it on the list to look at the animated series at all at the moment, but it kind of seems rude not to do it at some point.
I agree.
I think we'll probably go through the movies first, but at least looking at that first story, The Night of the Sentinels, I think it was, that's probably worth it.
Yeah, good idea.
Okay, should we go into our review then?
Let's go.
Okay, so straight away, we open up and we're in Nazi-occupied Poland. You have a young Eric Lencher who's basically getting separated from his parents, and they're entering Auschwitz, the concentration camp. And so really emotional scene where he's being separated there, and you can see that he's in a lot of stress, and that basically he's reaching out for his parents, and you see that the metal gates start to bend towards him. And the German soldiers are trying to keep hold of him and are getting pulled along, you know, by this young lad and being drawn towards those metal gates. And basically this happens for a few seconds on screen until one of the guards basically knocks him out. Now, talk about setting the tone straight off the bat for a movie. I can't remember if we said that I watched this at the cinema. Did you watch it at the cinema, or was it later on DVD or probably video?
No, DVD. I did watch the third one at the cinema. No, I watched this on DVD. I wasn't expecting it to be as good as it was, if I'm being honest, Dave, at the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, well, I mean, I was such an X-Men fanboy, there was no way I wasn't going to see this in the cinema. And I just remember being blown away by it, the seriousness of the tone, the subject matter and everything. I just thought it was executed brilliantly. And like I say, just set the tone for the rest of the movie there.
Yeah, really good. I mean, one thing I would say, Dave, is we mentioned this, and I mentioned this, and I was very, very critical, and we both joked around the stuff we've watched, and I know I keep saying this, but we've only got Nick Fury in especially Generation X, which is within the same universe as sorts, is this is done 2000, and like we were critical of Blade, where it was totally now you can watch it 20 years later, but there was still a few trips with the CGI and stuff, because obviously technology wasn't there now like it is now. You know, it's literally lifelike what they can do. Yeah. You can literally make a whole film without even needing human beings now, as we've seen with Avatar or whatever. You know, that's gone a couple of years now, but you've got that technology. With this, you can just see that it's the budget. Because there was a budget for this, and it doesn't look out of place like 18 years later. That whole scene, I love it. I absolutely love that fear on his parents' face because they've been separated. He's obviously absolutely in tears in here. And then the guy gives him a dig with a gun, and they all hit the deck, don't they, in the rain. But it still looks current now, which I think that's down to great directing and sort of future-proofing it in some respects, because you've invested that money, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think I seem to remember around about the time that the yardstick for a big blockbuster was more like 100 million. So yeah. Fox was still edging their bets a little bit. So they did. And I think that was why you ended up with Beast and things being cut, as you mentioned before. But yeah, I agree. I mean, it still looks great. And I don't know if those actors went on to do anything else. I haven't recognize them in anything else, but I thought that was a brilliant performance, and I think Bryan Singer probably has to take a lot of credit for that, because he hadn't done anything like this before, had he? He'd done one of my other favorites, not out of this genre, but The Usual Suspects, which I absolutely love. So you know, he's been used to tackling serious subject matter, and I just thought it was brilliantly executed, this opening scene.
Yeah, fantastic, Dave. Totally agree. And you know, it sets the film up. You're sort of thinking, all right, well, this is slightly different. And we don't know who this character is. Obviously, we know as comic book fans, but to the regular cinema goer, you're not really going to understand who this character is, are you? Which, again, ties in line with what you said about having some sympathy for Magneto, because obviously it is Magneto, but it really you don't really understand what's going on. You sort of think, is he one of the, you know, the goodies and sort of thing. So I like it. It sets the tone for the whole film. And then the next scene is we're at the US Senate, aren't we, where there's this talk about mutants, and again we're introduced to this sort of, you can tell straight away, this baddie as such, US Senator, who absolutely hates the mutants, don't he? And you know, he's there in the big forum, and then we pan to Professor X, and then you see the shadow of his head, and he's looking over. And I think Jean Grey's there, isn't she?
Yeah, and I think so. I mean, we say the baddie. I think the thing that X-Men comics tackled before the main Marvel universe tackled it was this idea that actually these superhuman beings are a bit scary. You know, and if left completely unregulated and no one does anything, well, you could have some serious consequences. So within the comics, you've got a lot of the baddies are human beings, you know, more so than just mutant v mutant. And so, you know, you can see the point that this Senator Kelly is trying to put across, and this Mutant Registration Act is basically, I think, the main idea. Well, actually, I'll go to where I think they stole that from. But, you know, later in leading up to Civil War, in the cinematic universe, it was called the Sokovia Accord, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yeah.
I think in the comics, it was just the Superhero Registration Act. I think it's been about 10 years now. So,
yeah.
So yeah, they came up with this. They were dealing with this before that, and having mutants being registered and what have you. And so I think you can understand Senator Kelly's perspective. Now, the thing that was a bit weird for me, and I think this is, you know, what's interesting when we go through these movies and we research a bit about, you know, the movie background and stuff, is sort of getting a little more of a peek behind the curtain to see how movies are actually made. And when I was thinking of that, I was looking at this scene and thinking, well, I can imagine Beast being where Jean Grey has stood. That'd be a very beast thing to be doing, you know, to be appealing to the Senate and speaking eloquently. It's not really a Jean Grey thing.
Yeah.
But it makes sense what you said before, that Beast, if Beast was dropped, well, they probably didn't want to make too many brutal changes to the script. And so it's like, oh, well, let's have Jean Grey in there. But that's a Beast role that's going on right there.
Which we see in the other, in the sort of the backstory stuff where the younger X-Men, don't we? You know, so you get Hank there. We get Kelsey Grammer, who plays him in the second one, but we get the young Hank, don't we? And he is that character, mm-hmm. isn't he? He's a politician of sorts, isn't he? He's a president at one point, isn't he? So I agree. And to be fair, Dave, I've never noticed that until you've just said it, but I totally agree knowing B's background. So yeah, good spot there, mate. Really good spot.
Yeah. So yeah, as you were saying before I cut across you, we see Professor X, don't we? And he can spot Eric across with his hat there, with his very good disguise. And so they have a bit of an interaction there, and you get this feeling, because this is the first time we've seen it on the big screen.
Yeah.
You get the feeling there's obviously a lot of history between the two, even though they don't see eye to eye. And I thought it was brilliant that little bit of an interaction there. And I do have to say, so I'd watched quite a few of the Star Trek Next Generation, and you know, it was for quite a few years before this came out that people were kind of fans were lobbying for Patrick Stewart to play Professor X. So I remember at the time I was like, oh, it's Professor X at last. With a cool little wheelchair there.
Well, Dave, let's be honest. He's never going to pull that wheelchair off as good as Deadpool did a few weeks ago. Well, yeah.
18 years later, and he's bombing around in it, old Deadpool.
I mean, is that obvious? I take it that Patrick Stewart stuff's because of Star Trek. Is that the whole...
I think it's probably just the most famous bald actor. You know, so people were thinking, oh, well, he's... make perfect Professor X.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that, Dave, again, great casting. Let's be honest. 18 years later, he was still doing the business, wasn't he? So,
yeah.
You know, obviously, we know that him and Hugh Jackman have bowed out at the same time, haven't they? Because he's vowed he will not play Professor X again after Logan. Yeah. So, what you get is you get this interaction, don't you, like you say, with them, and it's a respectful interaction, and you can see it's a calm before the storm. We're not too sure of exactly what's coming or what's actually happening, but we know that the two sides of a coin, that there's a friendship there. But and he says to him, Magneto and Eric, he says, you know, don't get him away, sort of thing, Charles, because he doesn't want to hurt him, because there's a friendship there. And even in that first exchange, you get that depth to the characters and that sort of mutual respect and even love, I think, in some respects.
Yeah, bit of a bromance. Before that word became a word.
Exactly, yeah. Now, Dave, the next scene is brilliant. I must admit, this scene's slightly unusual because she's in a bedroom with a boyfriend chatting away, and he seems quite comfortable laying on a bed. And I just don't buy that there's never been any touching between them. You know, like as in she's held his hand or anything like that. I'm saying that with the PG respects, obviously, but I've just realised what I've just said. I probably can't get it back up. But just say what I mean. It seems unusual that this lad has been allowed into her bedroom, and he's quite comfortable on a bed, but yet there's never been any sort of human touching between them.
Well, so the thing about the mutants, their powers aren't generally with them at birth.
Yeah.
Now, there's a few exceptions. I mentioned the other week, Hope was pretty much born a mutant and had her powers then. Jamie Madrox, Multiple Man, he had his powers from birth. But generally, their powers only tend to manifest themselves in their teenage years.
Right.
So they could have been canoodling before that. You like that word?
Yeah, because we are from the 1950s, Dave. Canoodling. they were heavy petting, wasn't it?
They may have been courting for some time.
When we were courting, when I was a lad, yeah.
And so there could have been some of that going on. And then her powers have just kicked in.
Babe, sorry, but it's no wonder we didn't get solo when we're saying stuff like canoodling and our credibility's gone right down the pan. Sorry, go on.
So again, I think that's what they're sort of saying there is that's the first time it's ever kind of kicked in.
Right, okay. Fair enough, yeah.
Again, when I talked about Gene kind of reading Beast's lines, if you like, for me, again, this whole character of Rogue, I thought Anna Paquin did okay in the movie. She's a good actress and what have you. But for me, this is Kitty Pryde. So in the comics, she's in her bedroom, her powers kick in, and she actually falls through the floor. She's the one who kind of can run through walls and stuff.
Yeah.
And her personality, the way she's kind of mentored, if you like, you know, Wolverine's a kind of big brother there. For me, this is written to be Kitty Pryde. It's just that they put Rogue in there. If you mentioned watching the animated series, you know, she's sort of strong, sassy, you know, very outgoing, sexy lady, isn't she, Rogue? And yeah. So this Rogue is a very different one.
Exactly. Sorry, Dave, it's cooked. She's got a very, very southern accent though in the cartoons as well, hasn't she? She's very she's like the female version of Wolverine in some respects, where she will literally, you know, she'll go in and die on a sword sort of thing. So this, I mean, obviously this is the origins of her character, but she's a very timid, like mouse like character, isn't she? She's really unusual. But again, like, you know that background. I don't I must admit, all these years I've watched it, I still think she's quite a weak character in this series of films. It doesn't ruin the film for me, but I just still think the use of her isn't, and I'm basing it off the cartoons, exactly like you've just said. So interesting, Dave, interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's still, it struck me as like a Dawson's Creek gone wrong scene. I still think it was executed quite well, you know, the way they did that there. So she's obviously fairly traumatized by putting this kid into a coma. She's very confused, doesn't know what's going on there. So she ends up running away. She does a bit of a Superman 2 style trek up the she goes up north. Maybe she's looking for the Fortress of Solitude there, but so she ends up in Alberta. She's a bit underwhelmed, I think, when the truck driver drops her off, isn't she? She's looking for a city, and he says that's it.
Yeah,
and she goes into this dive bar, and you see there's a cage match. Now, just I will tell you, I let my little lad watch this. He's a 12, but I let him watch it, and as soon as it was brilliant, because I was a bit older than him when I was watching this for the first time in the cinema, but his reaction was just like mine. You just get a little silhouette, don't you, into the cage, and the little lad's like, that's Wolverine. And I was like, yeah, that was me as well. As soon as he appeared on screen, and what you were saying about these little coincidences that ended up leading to Hugh Jackman actually landing the role, you just can't imagine anyone else.
No.
And, you know, so he's in there, he's fighting. And again, I've heard lots of people, you know, he's not the specimen that he would later become. But he's still quite a fit bloke, isn't he? You know, he still looks better than I do with my shirt off. Let's put it that way. So, you know.
Yeah, but it looks good.
It was a little bit different, wasn't it, to the Rips kind of Wolverine that we see in the later movies.
Yeah. And he looks good. I mean, I love the hair. I love everything about Inception. And this little interaction, she's coming, don't she? She's like the timid sort of girl. And she must understand that he's after she sees this beat down, because it's sort of like a circus act, and it roll up, who can knock this guy out or beat this guy. And we get the big knucklehead again, a Stone Cold Steve Austin lookalike, as mentioned before. And he just says to him, doesn't he, don't kick him in the you know what's because he'll, you know, he'll pee him off sort of thing.
It'll annoy him.
it'll annoy him. So what does he do? He says to him, well, anything goes, doesn't it? And he's like, yeah, but don't, you know. And anyway, he does. And that guy, Dave, I don't know whether the guy who actually says it, the promoter, is the guy out of Rocky One on the mic.
Oh, really?
He introduces Apollo Creed and Rocky just as a Rocky fanboy. Yeah, good spot. He's the guy who talks to Rocky the night before he fights Apollo and actually introduces him and stuff. But and he also the guy who introduces Thunderlips, you know, Hulk Hogan as well. But there you go. Yeah.
Thunderlips, yeah.
But yeah, so he's one of them things where he does do that. And then Wolverine absolutely nails him. And, you know, takes the money. And you can see Wolverine's then, he just looks like a caged animal, which it really depicts it very well, doesn't it? Like, he knows he's doing it to, you know, get a bit of cash in that, but he doesn't really want to be there because he feels like he's a freak sort of thing on show.
Yeah, and you get the little sound effects. And again, going back, I'm not sure I picked up on those, but I noticed this on this rewatch that when he gets hit, you hear the little metal sort of sound. You know, sort of telling us, oh, right, he must have some metal in him there. And when the guy tries to punch him and he punches his knuckle and basically breaks his hand kind of thing, I thought that looked great.
Yeah, he did. He looks brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And the only problem I've got with this scene, Dave, and this isn't a Chris Han Solo assassination because it's not, because I absolutely love these films, the X-Men, is after the fight, he obviously wins, knocks this guy out and stuff like that, headbutts him and stuff, and she's there talking to him, isn't she, Rogue and stuff. And, and the guy then wants to have a go at him. Now, someone, and probably like yourself, Dave, you know when you've met your match with somebody you can absolutely take you out, and even if you've given your best, then you've been beat. And having trained in this sort of thing, I know when I've been beat, whether it's a 15-year-old kid or a 50-year-old bloke, you pretty much know that you're out of your league. Why would you want to go back and prod the bear again? Because he didn't do very well in a controlled environment. How does he think in a barroom situation? I know it fits the film and stuff, but I always have a little problem with that, thinking, why would you be so stupid to go back?
So here's how I'd read it. So again, in this world, the mutants are persecuted. People kind of know that they're out there, but are very, very scared of them. Again, some people say it's a lot, you know, draws on a lot of parallels of racism, a lot of parallels with like homosexuality. So the humans are kind of scared of the mutants. But at the same time, they're kind of like bullying them as well.
Yeah.
So I think the reason, if it was just two blokes, you know, like you say, you wouldn't go and prod the bear again. But I think the fact that he's a mutant, he's seen as like, you know, less than human.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's kind of, that's how I interpreted it when he went back there. I have a slightly different problem. And it's just after he does that. So obviously, you know, he unleashes the claws, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So we get to see the claws for the first time. And you get to see that kind of knuckle-on view. So, the you know, if it was 3D, the claws would be coming out of the screen. And his skin just looks awful.
it does.
It looks like cloth.
Yeah.
You know, they've just put some slits in some cloth. And they had the claws come out. And every time it just jars with me a little bit. That it just looks awful.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's funny because I only noticed that today. In all the time, and I watched this film, I said to you before, I've watched this film recently in the last couple of months. I always go for a run of the X-Men. And I've never noticed it. But as we're reviewing it, and you're not trying to be overcritical. You enjoy it for what it is. You know the film and the beats of the film when it's up out. But yeah, that stuck out. And especially because of what we've seen, obviously, I know it's 18 years late, but with the Avengers and stuff, it's just gone up a complete level, hasn't it? Completely. It's been turned up to like 150 now, you know. So, yeah, I'm with you on that.
I'd noticed it. I don't know if I'd noticed it on the first time, but I've certainly seen, I've spotted it years ago. And it's one of those, I almost want to look away, but because I know it's there, I'm looking harder for it, if you know what I mean. So yeah. I just always notice it. Now, that's the only bit, though, when the claws pop out. I think other than that, I think the claws look great.
Oh, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And obviously, a bit of a reference here, Dave. I don't know if you've ever seen, you probably have. You've seen Police Academy, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Loved it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the guy behind the bar, the old bloke with the gun, he's the main baddie in Police Academy 1, who they chase around the streets when they're on that big rampage where everyone's just...
Right, okay. I do recognise him from somewhere.
Yeah, that's him, yeah. Yeah. I like Police Academy from years ago, so I just know that's the guy who gets punched in the end by Hightower because he's running a Mac. He's running a mock through the city, isn't he, and just kidnapping people. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's him. But again... That's great. That's a bit like Arnie's scene in Terminator 2 where he comes, he goes, I want you to close your boots and your motorcycle. You know, and that guy pulls the gun on him, and he goes, you know, I can't let you take his bike, son. And he just gets his sunglasses. He sort of just, he doesn't want to hurt the guy behind the bar. You know, he's pulled a shotgun on him and he's sort of like saying, don't push me. You know what I mean? Like, just you know your role sort of thing. But
yeah,
I like it because it sets up this scene where Rogue has gone and hid in his sort of, a camper van thing, which is an absolute mess in it. It's just like a proper rundown old thing from the 70s.
Yeah.
And they're off meandering down through like the sort of through the forest, really, in the snowy mountains or Rockies or whatever it is. And then he realizes that she's in the back and gets her in the front. And there's a bit of dialogue there. She's hungry and, you know, he's trying not to like her. And I think he's trying to play this sort of, I just don't want anybody around my situation, but I think he genuinely cares for the girl, doesn't he? We know that as the film goes on, but I thought Hugh Jackman plays it really well. Real, like, sort of moody, leave me alone character.
Yeah, just the ultimate loner, isn't he? And again, he does this a few times in the comics. He is that grumpy loner, but he does quite often take, tends to be young girls under his wing. You know, Kitty Pryde was one, later it would be Jubilee, you know, so he does kind of play that role. And like you say, I'm not sure if he had some beef jerky or something in the glove box but she was obviously starving. I don't think she had much of a plan when she set off, but yeah, looks out and I thought I really like this scene. I thought both of them played off each other quite well. And the bit that I really like is just that line about, you know, does it hurt? And it kind of looks at his knuckles and he just says every time.
Yeah.
Just a really nice bit of dialogue that's on your mind then. So, you know, throughout the movie, you know, well, it's not as if he doesn't feel pain. He feels everything. He just heals quicker. So when things happen to him, when he pops his claws and other stuff, you know that he's feeling pain there. So that kind of elevates his heroism for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does. And it's the anger, isn't it? The anger sees him through.
Yeah.
No matter how much it hurts him.
You know, and I will say this bit. So another little bit of trivia. So I believe Hugh Jackman, and this carried on throughout the other movies that he did as well. So to get into character, he used to get into a freezing cold shower because he's quite a nice bloke. Yeah. You know, he's a really nice bloke. Everyone loves working with him and everything. But to get into character and that kind of canned rage, he said he did it by accident once where his wife was asleep and he got in the shower and didn't realize it wasn't hot water at first. He got in and he was just full of this bottled up rage. He obviously thought, oh, that's quite a good way to get into character.
Yeah, clever. I didn't know that, Dave.
Yeah. I thought it was funny.
Yeah, nice little slip it. Slip it, Dave. A snippet. Slip it. Another word. It's another
it's slip another. It. Slip it in there. I like that.
Yeah, it's a bad one, that. Sorry. But yes, and then we get the dialogue. He gives her the beef jerky. He sort of loses his temper a little bit, doesn't look up, and then all of a sudden this tree just falls, doesn't it? And he goes head first through his windscreen because she's saying to him, get your seatbelt on.
Yeah.
And he goes flying, doesn't he, like 50 feet down the road. And, you know, she's panicking because she can't get out of the actual seatbelt because she's stuck. And then what I like, Dave, is he gets up and he like creaks his neck and he's standing there. And then all of a sudden you can see he can smell something, can't he? And the claws come out again, which is brilliant. I love it. Absolutely love it. Absolutely love it. And then Sabretooth jumps from nowhere and just absolutely takes him out. But what's funny, Dave, watching the Origins film, and I know, you know, Peter gets slated, but I actually quite like that film, is Sabretooth's his brother, but there's no mention of it in this. He's not even in relation to it, is it? You know, is that something in the comics that he's always been his brother? Did they just not even mention it in this?
So in the comics, Wolverine's origin was always a bit vague.
Yeah.
And so what they'd always do, you know, again, like the Joker, so different writers would kind of hint at different things, and it wouldn't all be consistent. And the way that they'd kind of get around that is say, well, his memory's not what it was, you know. And they're doing a similar thing with Deadpool. There's a storyline, it's probably a few years ago now. It's like a dangling thread that's never been picked up again. But there's another character in the Marvel Universe who claims he's the real Wade Wilson and Deadpool stole his identity. So, and I think I mentioned when we did the Deadpool run that I think one of the later ones that I'd read, and I'm a little bit behind on the Deadpools now, but it was kind of hinting at the fact that actually he murders his own parents, but then he's been kind of brainwashed to forget it all, you know. So with this Weapon X stuff, they can do pretty much anything and take your memories away and what have you. So what Marvel did when they knew that Fox were looking at putting together a Wolverine Origins movie, they quickly got out their own story. And so some of that story is actually the first bit of that Wolverine Origins movie. And so Sabretooth is there, but they're not actually related, but they did have a relationship together.
Right. You know,
they were friends, not like having a relationship. I don't think that was out when this movie was out.
Right.
So, you know, they've long had a needle between them, but I don't think it spelled it out like that before. So I can kind of forgive the moviegoers, the filmmakers a little bit. The second thing I would say is I wouldn't get too hung up about, and I know I will. So I'm sort of telling you, but I'm telling myself as well. Wouldn't get too hung up about consistency between those X-Men movies.
Yeah.
Because if you think, not even deeply, but if you think a little bit more than 5 seconds about some of the consistencies of it, it all starts to unravel.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of the X-Men lore, the X-Men canon, they play around with alternative timelines. So I kind of have it in my mind that this is kind of a different timeline. And they did that with Days of Future Past, didn't they, later? Where they completely, you know, and obviously rewrote a new timeline there.
Yeah, yeah. And Logan as well, in some respects, is supposed to be an alternate.
That's right.
Well, yeah. So, yeah. Good spot, Dave. Sorry, carry on. Sorry about that.
While we're talking about Wolverine Origins, though, I think a lot of people do like Liv Schreiber's portrayal of Sabretooth. I prefer this one. I think the look of him, the physical size of him, I quite like this Sabretooth. Now, he doesn't say much, does he? But, you know, just, again, the physical presence of him, the fact that he towers over Wolverine, I think he looks great.
That's what I mean, because he was a wrestler. He's about 6'4", 6'5". He's a big bloke, you know, and I think he was in WCW in the 90s, you know, around when Hulk Hogan had left the WWF and stuff.
It wasn't the main, isn't it?
Yeah, he wasn't a world-famous wrestler. He's more what they call like a jobber and a bit of a background guy. But they have these guys who are just, they don't have the charisma on the camera, but they've got the physical attributes. That's what they go off. And he was plucked from that. I remember watching the making of this around 2001, something like that. So,
right.
But yeah, it's a good battle as well, though, Dave, because he is the foil for Wolverine that we need, really.
Yeah, yeah. And so, again, it's a little bit of a, maybe we'll discuss it later, a bit of a leap of logic, because we find out after what they're after.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how they know what yeah. they're after, if you know what I mean. So I'll explain that cryptic statement more a little bit later. But yeah, we get the guys in there, don't we? And a little bit of a showdown. And then again, I thought this opening bit was brilliant. You get to see a bit of wind, and then you see Storm and Cyclops just down the path there.
Yeah.
And Cyclops unleashes a blast, an optic blast. And I thought, you know, again, it's hard for me to watch this without the nostalgia and just think back to that very first time I watched it. And I just thought, oh, brilliant. That looks yeah. great.
Which he does. It looks, even now, Dave, 18 years later, as I said before, it holds up. It really does hold up. And he's a good Scott Summers as well, isn't he? He's like that straight-laced, you know, school kid, grade A school kid who they've got. He's a clever lad, and he just plays it all down the line, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's a good foil for Wolverine as well.
Yeah, some of the interactions are quite good, aren't they, as the movie goes on?
Yeah, some good one-liners.
Yeah. So they're taken back to the X-Mansion, and Wolverine's having a bit of a medical there by Jean Grey. I mean, there's worse people to have a medical done by than Famke Janssen, isn't there? If you have to have one done. So so yeah, and again, not to labour the point from before, I think this was intended to be Dr. Hank McCoy.
Yeah.
So. But, you know, you could have big blue furry beast or Famke Janssen give you a medical. So I know where my vote would be. So anyway, there's a little bit of a little bit of tension, isn't there, between the two of them?
Yeah.
And then initially I'm thinking of the scene later that's like this one. No, he just kind of wakes up, doesn't he? And she's giving him a medical and then basically escapes.
Yeah, and he grabs her, doesn't he? He jumps up and grabs
yeah.
her. And then Professor Xavier's talking to him, isn't he? And he can't understand where the voices are coming from. So he's sort of gone into stealth mode, hasn't he? Within sort of outside Cerebro, obviously. We know Cerebro's in the room, but he's in that area, in the sort of clinical X type room. And then he ends up back into the mansion, doesn't he? Sort of going through a doorway.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And he's in his head, and then obviously he's seeing people run past him, children, everything, and he just ends up bursting into a door. And then Professor Xavier's teaching a load of kids, doesn't he? And he goes, "Oh, welcome, Logan," sort of thing.
Yeah.
Again, good little scene. And then isn't that where he turns round and he's got Cyclops and Storm right next to him?
Yeah. So because he's basically, there's a bit of a needle, isn't there, straight away with these two. So Wolverine looks like he's going to walk out, and Cyclops is kind of stood in his way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's that bit. And then, but then they kind of convince him because, that's it. Professor X says, like, you know, it's been 15 years, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And so, you know, he kind of lures him in that way. And then we learn a little bit more about the school. And so we get a bit of a walk around. We get to see some of the kid mutants show their powers. And I still, you know, the basketball scene was a bit weird, wasn't it? Because he has like Nightcrawler teleporting powers. But in basketball, you can't pass to yourself, can you?
No. No.
Foul. Again, a stupid thing that you know, you're not supposed to focus on. But I was like, that's calling for a foul.
But Dave, to be fair, at that point, I was just waiting for a pathetic Irish accent going, "No, don't do that. Don't do that again." Yeah. Banshee.
That's the problem with watching it in that order, isn't it? With Banshee first. a Canadian Irish accent. But I tell you what the interesting thing is, because it was a school right back to that very first issue, but it wasn't the kind of populated school that it's shown to be here.
Yeah.
Now there was a Grant, a writer called Grant Morrison who took up who did a run from 2001 called it, and they called the book The New X-Men, and that had more of a, it was more of a full school
you know, so you had lots of mutants in the background and what have you. So I think the movie did influence the comics a little bit there.
Yeah.
So yeah, Professor X tells Logan about Magneto, and he's kind of confused about what his interest in Wolverine actually is. And so he basically asks him to stick around while they try and find out why. And also he's going to help him kind of get back his memories that he's lost.
Yeah.
And we also see, so Rogue slips in quite easily, doesn't she, into school life there. And we get to see a little, we don't, for me, have nearly enough Iceman in any of these X movies, but we do see a little bit of Iceman using his powers there, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. And again, another one, Dave, like you say, you're totally right. He's like a peripheral figure, really. Maybe it's a budget thing, but it would have been nice to have someone like that, especially with him being at the end, as we know, at the Statue of Liberty. It would have made more sense to have someone like the Iceman there.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever see Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so again, I just always loved Iceman since then, and they've just never, I think Days of Future Past was the best I've seen them do him, but not nearly enough Iceman in these movies. Hopefully they'll put a bit more if they end up rebooting it under Marvel.
He was a great character. Now you said that, Dave, Iceman, he was like integral in that whole team, wasn't he? It was brilliant. I used to love that cartoon.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that. Saturday morning job. Anyway,
absolutely.
Sorry.
So, yeah, and then, we're introduced to the school, and the scene is set, isn't it, from the X-Men point of view. We then go across to Senator Kelly, who's, you know, he's on his mission to push this act through, this Mutant Registration Act, and we see Toad. He's not very inconspicuous, is he? The bloke's green. But he's the pilot, and no one spots that the pilot's green. But Mystique is there. She's got the makeup. And again, considering it was 2000, the makeup and the transformation from one person into Mystique, I thought it looked okay. I thought it stood up quite well. If you were to do it now, and, you know, even from when they did it with Jennifer Lawrence, it looks better now, of course, but I still thought it stood up quite well there.
Yeah, I've got to agree with you there, Dave. I mean, 18 years later, and, you know, we've seen various different incarnations of Mystique as the films have grown and the CGI's got better. But I think this was sort of like the flag bearer, other than maybe it being in HD and the textures of a body being slightly more defined and with a bit more detail. I have no issue with it. I think it's great CGI, and it's not really something we'd seen properly when you get this sort of morphing people right in front of your eyes. I thought it was a real sort of flag bearer, really, and absolute leading the light with this sort of thing. I loved it, absolutely love it. And obviously she changes, and she then, you know, says to, you know, people like you, the reason I didn't want to go to school. And then she just you know, gets him, his security guy, kills him, and then takes him out, and then they're ready to, you know, they take him off to see Magneto then at his lair sort of thing.
Yeah.
But brilliant.
And they're actually, I don't know if they mention it. I mean, it kind of looks like any villain's island, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like the guy out of The Incredibles. But I think it's supposed to be Genosha, which is, again, it's quite well known in the comics as being a place that initially mutants were taken there to be tortured and put to work and what have you, but then they kind of claimed it as their own. And it gets a little bit silly here for me. So, you know, one of the leaps of logic, you know, because one of the things I really like about the X-Men, typically they've just got one thing that's exaggerated, this extra ability.
Yeah.
You know, even Wolverine, you know, he's got, I'm pretty sure when I was a kid, I gravitated to him just because he looked cool. You know, he's got the big claws, he's got great big, great yellow suit and whatever. I think that's what I liked about him, not his healing powers or anything, but, you know, even that, you just say, well, he just heals really quickly. Okay, well, if you had someone who healed really quickly, you could, you know, experiment on his body and he'll just heal from it, unlike, you know, normal humans would.
Yeah,
but this whole machine. So they basically, you know, they've got Kelly tied up there, and then Magneto gets himself into this machine, and there's a bit of dialogue between them. You know, are you a God fearing man? And, you know, God works a little bit too slowly, and you've just got this machine that's come out of nowhere. Like, who's built this machine?
Yeah.
Again, it's an X-Men movie, so I don't need to rationalize everything, but it's too far for me to jump to be completely on board with. You know, this machine's just made by someone, you know, and it's just there, and it turns people into mutants. So it all seemed a bit out of place with the serious tone that had been set. You know, this bit, it was a bit more comic booky, if you like.
Yeah, yeah. It did, like you say, sometimes it just dispels logic. You just got to go with it, haven't you? Because I didn't really have a problem with it, but I totally get what you're saying. If you look too much into it, it logically doesn't make sense, does it?
Yeah. But I liked, again, so you don't quite know, you know, watching it for the first time, you don't quite know what's happened to him. But then you see him in his cell, don't you? And he puts his face up against the bars, and he starts to squash in between the bars. And I thought that held up pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't look completely realistic, but for 2000, I thought it looked pretty good there.
And I think 2 years early, we mentioned and sort of marked down the Blade incident where they sort of turned into like human, I don't know, they just basically self-imploded, didn't they, and blew up sort of thing when he done it to some of the vampires.
Yeah.
I'll get my words out at some point, Dave. But, you know, and that did, we did both say that looks a bit poor, but this didn't. And I agree. It didn't. It makes sense for what it was. It really did. It was almost connotations back to Terminator 2 when Robert Patrick's the T-1000 and he goes through them bars. Mm-hmm. And the gun gets stuck in the bar and the way he goes through.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that is great CGI, even back in 1992. But,
yeah
it was good. No problem with that. And obviously, we get Sabretooth comes in, don't we? And, you know, he's trying to get hold of him, and he's got hold of his hand, holding him on this cliff edge.
Yeah.
Because he's slipping and he's slimy. He's got like a mutation now. He slips and Magneto comes in at that point. They think he's dead, don't they? And what makes me laugh is, though, Magneto, because of I love that bit where, because of the metal and what he can do, bending the, you know, the rules of everything, he leaves Sabretooth, doesn't he?
I like that bit as well. Just that just stay there, you know.
Yeah, and he gives a roar, though, doesn't he? Like a lion, which is great. He like has a bit of like a little petulant child, as if to say, I can't believe you've locked me in this room. You know, I think that's good. It's a good little jokey scene, that.
Yeah. And then we move across to back to the X-Mansion, and Rogue, for some reason, is going to go into Wolverine's room. And Wolverine's obviously tormented by, you know, these dreams of Weapon X and being experimented on. He doesn't really know what's happened. And us, as the movie goes, we haven't been subjected to Wolverine Origins yet. So we kind of don't really know what's going on there. But then, you know, she's trying to check that he's okay. And then, you know, leaps out of bed and sort of ends up skewering her with his claws there, which is a pretty horrible scene. Again, when you're watching it for the first time, you don't know what's going to happen. They've shared this nice little rapport on the road there. They seem to get on quite well, and you think, oh, crikey, this could be the end for Rogue. And then she ends up just stealing his powers so that she can heal up, and quite quick
quick thinking there, because she'd only kissed that one boy, hadn't she?
Yeah.
So she, well, at least on screen, we didn't see her demonstrate her powers at all. She certainly hadn't stolen the powers of another mutant. But there we get to see she's stolen a bit of his healing factor, and you can see from her back all those puncture wounds were healed up. Again, I thought it was quite a nice effect to show, you know, the different powers there.
Yeah, good. It's really good. And obviously Wolverine then goes into a sort of enforced coma, doesn't he? Because, you know, she's took away his sort of invincibility and powers of recovery. I think it's, there's a good scene here, which sort of makes sense, but doesn't. He's, you know, we've got Bobby Drake, obviously her boyfriend, haven't we? Or a sort of crush, the sort of friend, whatever he is in this. And, you know, he has a bit of dialogue with her and says to, like, you know, Professor X is angry with you. You know, you're going to have to leave, which didn't really make much sense because she'd only just... But also, how easy it was, in the end, we find out it's Mystique, but how easy it was for her to get in there. Well, why didn't she just take her? If it was that easy for her to get in there, into sort of Professor X's mansion, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to explain it, but I can't explain it.
So how did Mystique break into the mansion?
Yeah, quite easily, though.
Yeah, so I that's interesting. I didn't think of it that way. I mean, it is a school.
Yeah.
So it's not an army base or something that she's breaking into. So, and she is Mystique. Yeah. Now, if you take another leap and you say, well, hang about, why doesn't Professor X?
That's what I was getting at. Yeah, that's what I meant.
Recognize Mystique's in the vicinity because he grew up with her. If we go across to X-Men First Class, I'm going to call different timeline again.
Yeah, we're going to have to. It's not something to slate the film because I enjoy it, but it's just them little things thinking it's got to go because of the plot. I understand that because there's no point having a mass fight in the mansion and the end and that's it sort of thing. I get that. But you like you always say, you're right, you've just got to go with it and dispel belief sometimes.
Yeah, the bigger question I have is how does Magneto and co. know about Rogue?
Mm. Yeah.
She's basically kissed a boy, put him in a coma. How does Magneto know?
Well, it's not like he's got the same powers as Professor X. Professor X would know about her because he would know, and he's probably hidden it from people as well as the family because of his mind control. He sort of controls the universe, doesn't he, of these mutants. He knows everyone, as we know with the comment of Wolverine, it's been 15 mm-hmm. years. So again, like you say, I knew that's what you were getting at earlier on because that's always the sort of thing, again, where you just have to, I think it's just...
You just have to go with it, don't you?
Yeah.
But yeah, so she runs off and she leaves the school. We actually see, and again, I think it's quite a nice effect that, Bobby kind of walks past and then you see another Bobby kind of walking out, which is the Mystique Bobby. I thought it was quite nicely done just to show you that you've got the shapeshifter there.
Yeah. Again, no problem with it, Dave, at all.
Yeah, but then actually turning yourself so that you look like someone else, I can buy. That's one step from reality that I can buy. The fact that she can change into Professor X and exactly match his eye retina for the retina scan.
Yeah.
That was like, oh, come on. Surely you can't just look at someone and then see, oh, right, and then match their molecular makeup and everything. So, again, it was just one of those silly little things that I thought was a leap too far for me to just swallow whole.
Yeah, especially the way she changed Cerebro and stuff. Again, Professor X, was he asleep or was he having a coffee or something? Does he have half an hour a day where he decides he's just going to switch his brain off? I don't know. Again, it's not stuff to pick holes like we did with Solo because I absolutely love the film, but there is just a few little nitpicks there, here and there, where you, like you say, you've just got to roll with the punches. And
you know, from there we get this scene where Rogue goes, and then Scott and Storm go down, don't they? They realize that she's gone, and they're trying to find her. And I like this bit when he goes into the garage, and we've got all these nice sports cars there, don't he? And he turns to the right and goes, "Where's my bike?" You know, and then you get the next bit. It's Wolverine, and he puts it into overdrive, doesn't he? And just absolutely like a 1960s Batman cutscene, sort of the way it goes, because he just goes like hell for leather, doesn't he, to get to the train station to find her. But again, this train station scene, I love, Dave. I like the whole build up to it. We've got the dynamics of Wolverine. We've got, you know, he finds Rogue on the train, and then we've got Storm and Scott, don't we? And you think like they're going to be fine, but then Sabretooth just comes powering through the queue, doesn't he, and just grabs her by the neck, grabs Storm around the neck and stuff. And you know, we then get the thing where Ray Park's character Toad, he flicks Scott's glasses off, doesn't he, and it all just kicks off in the train station and everything. And I love all that, because it's like the baddies are getting the upper hand again, aren't they, and stuff. But then Storm just kicks in again, don't you, with a bit of lightning, and you know, they end up sort of taking him out completely, Sabretooth then.
Yeah, and if I can just go back for a little second, I love that scene. The back and forth between Cyclops and Wolverine throughout this movie, I quite like the little digs that they're getting into each other, and the fact that he's nicked his bike. I just think it's brilliant. But when he finds that boost button and it sends him flying, the joy on his face as he's just flying along the road, I just thought it was absolutely brilliant. And I think I'd forgotten about that, but just on the rewatch today, just I just noticed it, and I thought, oh, that's just brilliant.
Yeah, well, class, absolute class.
But getting into, yeah, you're right, and so they do get the upper hand, don't they? All of them, you know, Cyclops is there. He's not got his visor, so he's pretty much incapacitated because he can't open his eyes to see anything, or else he's going to blast everyone. But then, and then it's not until Storm, you know, fortunately he blows the roof off, so Storm can unleash some weather power on old Sabretooth there.
Yeah. I think as well, David, this scene fits in with what you said regarding the human behavior towards mutants, because if you were just a human bystander, and I know I'm thinking around like outside the fourth wall now, but you wouldn't know who's good or bad, would you? Let's be honest. You know,
exactly.
So you were right. You're totally right what you were saying, and I get that now that you said that. It is, people just be running for cover because you see Storm absolutely take the train station apart, don't you, to get this. Obviously, this guy's got around the neck, and it's a man grabbing a woman. So in any realms, you'd be like, what's going on here? You know, he's the bad person in whatever role alive. But again, how would anybody know? So I get, you are right. People just seem to fly and stay out of the way of these things.
And the, you know, the quote unquote goodie Cyclops has just blown the roof off. Now, exactly. if you're in that train station with your kids, you know, it's not that hard to think how people could be, you know, surrounded, you know, be wrapped up in all this fear and want mutants to be registered and what have you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh, and Dave, by the way, let's just go back slightly a couple of scenes, but we did see a Stan Lee cameo as well, didn't we?
Oh, you're right. So when old Senator Kelly pops out the water there, he's just there. He's by like a hot dog stand or an ice cream stand or something, isn't he? It's very, very subtle Stan Lee cameo. He doesn't say, he usually has a line or two, doesn't he?
Mm. He's just staring. I mean, to be fair, I don't think I've ever seen that before, noticed it properly. I think I may have done, but it's never bothered me. But this time it really stood out because I was analysing everything going on in the background for little Easter eggs. But yeah, sorry, I've gone too far back, but I just thought I'd drop it in there.
No, that's all right. So I think then we get, we actually go to the train, don't we? So all this is kicking off in the train station, but we go into the train, we see Wolverine's actually found Rogue. And again, I just like the way they play up that big brother role. And he's, you know, he's not telling her to, he's not being draconian and kind of telling her to go back or anything. He's just, you know, saying, let's give these guys a chance. But then
Magneto turns up, and again, we've seen enough of the movie now to know that Wolverine's pretty bad, isn't he? But of course, against the Master of Magnetism, he's not really much use.
No.
And all along this way, we've been led to believe, although Professor X says earlier in the movie, doesn't he? He says something like, it may not be this guy they're after. You know, he foreshadows quite a bit. When Jean Grey's kind of showing some of the X-rays, and in fact, I'll say for that bit where she's showing the X-rays and she's going on about, you know, his regenerative powers, and she says, because of these, you know, we don't really know how old he is. And then she turns to Patrick Stewart and says, he might even be older than you, Professor. That's a bit harsh.
Yeah, I thought the same today when I was watching it. I swear to you, I'm not just agreeing with you. I swear I was laughing to myself thinking, well, that's like a little kid would say to the parent, isn't it? You know, you've got to be, a bit older, Dad, or something. You know what I mean? But yeah, clever. Yeah, clever.
You know, being older, you know, you realise actually no one ever feels old. Even when you're old, you don't feel old. You know, and I don't think you'd appreciated that one.
No. And then this is a great scene again, because we're on the train now and Wolverine's talking to her, and then it stops, doesn't it? The train starts to sort of take off from the platform, and you know, he's trying to convince her to come back, and he finally sort of gets a bit of headway with it, and then Magneto appears, doesn't he? And this is a great scene because, like you said, he's totally redundant, Wolverine, totally redundant at this point. And he gets he's mad up, and then the claws come out and you're thinking, all right, it's going to be a showdown. It's like, no, not really. He just lifts him up, bends his claws a bit and just throws him through the carriage, doesn't he? And he says a great bit of dialogue to it, because he says to him, what do you want with me? And he goes, you said he wanted you, you know, and then Logan looks, doesn't he, as he's in utter pain because Magneto's got him elevated above the air because of the adamantium, and looks at her as if to say, oh dear. And that's when he throws him, doesn't he, through the carriages, and she then does a runner, but he has this needle in his pocket and sort of catches her as she's just getting through the carriages, doesn't it, and knocks unconscious.
So that was the reveal for Logan, but it was also for us as well, wasn't it? It was just to tell us, oh wait, you know, he's not after him, he's actually after her. And I thought, again, the first time I watched it, I thought that was a good reveal, because it's only in later watches that I picked up on the foreshadowing that Professor X had said earlier in the movie.
Because you do think, because to be fair, Dave, the one thing about watching this time, and like I say, even I watched it a few months ago, it feels, because he's such a product, it does feel a bit like a Wolverine origin film, doesn't it? Even though it's X-Men, Hugh Jackman's character is so pivotal in the whole thing, and I said it right this time.
You did. But I think, so let's be honest, right? All of the X-Men movies, apart from Deadpool, and he even gets a fair few mentions in there, doesn't he? All of the X-Men movies, the earlier ones, are Wolverine movies.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, just to go off on a slight tangent, that's why I think in the Avengers movies, in particular the Infinity War, they've done such a great job of giving, you know, it's been a genuine team ensemble type movie, whereas this is, it's more centered around Wolverine and Rogue, and the other characters are just there. They're part of the furniture, aren't they?
Yeah, they're just backups, aren't they, really?
Yeah.
It is. You're right. I think, and that's not setting it apart. I think that's why Wolverine's such an important character, and Hugh Jackman is the guy he is and the actor he is now because of what they did with this. Very clever. But yeah, it all just feels like it's everything, and it has to be, because to be fair, he's the best goodie in the whole film, let's be honest. Other than Professor X, who's a great character, Wolverine is the man.
Yeah, and just in terms of popularity, I mean, Wolverine is the most popular X-Man. I mean, for the fanatics, for the real X-Men fans, a lot of them don't like him,
But in terms of just pop culture, he is the most popular one.
Yeah, exactly. And then now from there, Dave, I'm losing it a bit, but isn't the next scene where Magneto has the police and the guns? Is that the scene?
Yeah, so they're coming out of the train station, aren't they? They've made the kidnap, and Toad's got Rogue over his shoulder. And then the next thing you see, this huge saber-tooth hand around Magneto's neck there.
Yeah.
And obviously, doesn't he tap on his helmet or something? I can't think. Somehow we know that the helmet's stopping Professor X from getting into Eric's
head. Mind.
But he's obviously controlling Toad and Sabretooth. And quite like this scene. It's definitely one of those standout scenes that I remembered, you know, even before the rewatch, thinking back to. And basically, Eric gets one over on Charles here, doesn't he? Because he's basically turned all the guns on the cops, and you know, he's basically threatening to shoot them all. And he's like, "Well, you know, I don't know, I can stop them all." And pretty cool. So he ends up releasing his hold on Sabretooth and Toad, and they effectively escape then.
Yeah, because there's a great scene, Dave, which was like pop culture references with films, is with the guns turned on the police, is when that actual bullet is spinning in the cop's forehead and it's ready to go in. I love that scene because it adds a bit of tension. Will he release it? Will he release? You know he's going to release him, but you're like, you know.
It does, but what was holding the cop in place? I mean, it was turning away on his head. And, you know, have a little bit of a friction burn there. And I'm just looking at it and thinking, just move out the way.
I didn't think of that.
Well, yeah, again, obviously the director didn't either, or whoever it was. But it's good for the effect. And again, it's just one of those things, probably less than 1% of people notice it. But this wasn't just on this rewatch. When I've watched it before, I thought, well, you know, fair enough, after the gun goes off, you're not going to dodge a bullet. But when it's spinning into your head, you know, it just moved backwards.
Oh, Dave, you just ruined it.
Sorry.
I'm not joking.
Well, actually, but, Dave, I'm going to counter that by saying he had metal in his belt and Magneto was controlling his belt, so he couldn't move anyway.
Maybe he had those little metal things in his collars. Because his badge? Even if it's his badge, it would have to be his neck, wouldn't it? Because he could just move his neck either side. Maybe he had earring. Or metal plate in his
metal
head.
Metal plate in his neck or something.
Yeah, there we go. Just rationalised it.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And then the next scene is obviously Senator Kelly arrives at the house, doesn't he? He lets Magneto go. He gets off with Rogue and they all go off then back to his lair as such. And, you know, Kelly's on his way out, but he does give the information out about what Magneto's up to, doesn't he, with this machine.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've mentioned Deadpool a few times already, but I'm going to mention it again. I think in the Deadpool review, I said I didn't really like the fact that Weapon X were experimenting on him and they were able to turn normal human beings into mutants.
Yeah.
And I guess when I was talking about that, I'd kind of forgotten about this whole storyline, because that's what they're doing here, isn't it? It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll give them a little bit more credit. It's different to the comics, but maybe in the cinematic Fox X-Men world that you can just turn normal humans into mutants. Yeah. I think it still doesn't sit perfectly with me, because, you know, it's like you're supposed to have this X gene and you inherit your genes, you know, from your most immediately your parents, who inherited genes from their parents and so on and so on. So you've either got it or not, you know, and this kind of storyline just says, well, anyone can just be mutated. It doesn't sit perfectly with me.
No, because I agree with you. I totally agree. I think the thing is as well, Dave, is it defies logical explanation. It's like what he's trying to do is inject and inflict what they've gone through on the whole world. And really, it doesn't really make sense, does it, as such?
Well, so the fact that they've got this machine that can do that doesn't make sense to me. Now, if you're victimized by this group of people, and you can flick a switch and you can get them over to your side of the fence, well, they're not going to victimize you anymore.
No.
So you can kind of see, because Magneto is not trying to do it to the whole world. He's trying to do it to the politicians, isn't he? You know, he's trying to turn them, the very people who are pushing through this Mutant Registration Act, he's trying to turn into mutants. And they've got political power, haven't they? So I can kind of accept that. It's just the fact that he has a machine to do it that I think, that's too far.
Yeah, yeah. And really, there's not really a proper explanation as to how he gets it. We do get it, but it doesn't... You've just got to roll with the punches again, like we said before. There's a couple of little missteps in the way. You've just got to go with it, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yep. We kind of learn, though, don't we? So why has Magneto been after Rogue? Well, obviously this machine does take a lot out of Eric, and you know, even when he transformed Senator Kelly, you know, it nearly killed him. So
yeah,
his plan is, you know, he's going to transfer some of his powers to Rogue. He's going to hook her up to the machine. It'll kill her, but that's a kind of sacrifice that it's for the greater good, as he sees it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's all I can say, Dave. Yeah.
So I quite liked, so when, and to the point that I was saying before, that, you know, if you bring these guys over to your side of the fence, you see, don't you, Senator Kelly on the hospital bed kind of thing there. And he's obviously, he knows he's in trouble, doesn't he? He knows he's been mutated, and he sort of senses storms there. And he doesn't want to be on his own. And, you know, you can see he's starting to, his molecules aren't holding together anymore. And again, I'm sure I'd seen somewhere the visual effects guys who worked on this weren't too happy with this scene. But I thought it looked all right. Again, I guess I'm looking through with forgiving eyes. But that transformation from, you know, actor to this blob, to this water, I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you on that. I honestly think, Dave, the CGI was ahead of its time in this film. A lot of it, like you say, the Wolverine claw thing, yeah, fair enough. You're not going to get everything right. And that's quite a hard thing to pull off anyway, isn't it, as an actual illusion. They try and do it. And I agree with you. It's more a 3D illusion these days, isn't it? So you are sort of rolling with the punches. But I thought it was fine, absolutely fine. And again,
I think you're right. I think the if we think, yeah, well, actually, we'll leave Matrix out of it.
Yeah.
But if we think Blade was 2 years before, and, you know, some of the CGI there where you had Stephen Dorff, old Deacon Frost, turning into the Blood God and getting chopped in half and then gluing back together. Compared to this, that looked awful.
Yeah.
This looks great.
It does. No, it does. It looks great. It looks real good. And, you know, again, this is why I think it got such good reviews, Dave, and it holds up well now, because, you know, to be at 81% after 18 years, you know, and I know obviously the main reviews were out when it first came out, but it doesn't matter. It's still bang on. Do you know what I mean? Absolutely brilliant. So, no, cracking. Really good. Really good.
Yeah. And then so Professor X, he's going to use the same trick as he used before. He's going to use Cerebro to try and find Rogue, which he'd done previously when she was on the train. But, of course, Mystique, she's sabotaged Cerebro. presumably because Magneto helped him build it, he knows how to sabotage it. So it's just, you just see him put some oil or something into the machine that's obviously not a good thing, and then that effectively fries Xavier and completely takes him out of the game, doesn't it?
Yeah, completely. And this is where you said before about sort of Mystique going into Cerebro and stuff. You've just got to go. I don't know, I've said that a few times now. You just got to go with it. It happens. He takes him out of the film, and then it's a good way of setting up the fact that they haven't got the comfort blanket of Professor Xavier as well. They've got to sort these things out for themselves as a team, which I think if they didn't have Wolverine, as much as he needs them, they need him more, I think, because of his pure sort of not giving a damn, basically. I was going to swear then, but not giving a damn.
Yeah. I must admit, again, first time I saw it, I was really shocked that they took Professor X out of the game there.
Yeah.
Because in the comics, he's pretty much, I mean, not so much in more recent years, but the ones that I'd read through the 80s and whatever, he's pretty much always there. You know, when they're out on the battlefield, he's kind of conducting it all, you know, and you see this big head in the panel while Cyclops is doing something or Wolverine's doing something. So it was quite a big shock to me that they took him out like that, and then they'd be on their own out in the field.
Yeah. But it makes the team, doesn't it? I think that's what it's doing. It's setting up for the second one then as well, isn't it? Because they've got to do this battle alone, because Charles is the only one who's really has the beating of Magneto as such.
And it gives Jean Grey an opportunity to stand up as well, doesn't it? Because she said earlier in the movie she's telekinetic.
Yeah.
And then And a bit telepathic. And then I think it's Wolverine who says, oh, like the professor. And she's like, oh, nowhere near as powerful. And so she's never used Cerebro before, but she steps up here, doesn't she? And, you know, she finds out that Magneto's across on the Statue of Liberty. So, you know, she's basically going to mutate all of the world leaders. And that's his plan. So going into the final act then, so they're all getting suited up, aren't they? And they're gonna head out on the Blackbird over to the Statue of Liberty. And that's where we get the little line, isn't it, about the leather suits. You can see kind of Hugh Jackman moving about in it, and he's saying, well, you know, what would you want? Yellow spandex. And I think I'd heard somewhere that, you know, in the very early kind of pre-production, they did try out some of the traditional costumes, and they didn't go down too well. If it was anything like that costume at the end of Generation X, I know why. And I still think, you know, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., was definitely one of the inputs into having these kind of monochromatic matching leather suits each there.
Yeah.
But I they're not X-Men if you look at the comics, but I still think they look pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think as well, Dave, it is influenced. We were laughing, like say Nick Fury, we were laughing about stuff like that when he had the leather on, and then you got Blade as well. But I think you couldn't have the Lycra stuff, could you? And the colours, it wouldn't have, I mean, as in wearing them yellow and blue suits, it wouldn't have gone, would it, with the tone of the film?
I think now they might be able to do it somehow. You know, because I think around that time, it was still very much spandex based, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas
you
look at the MCU now, and they're quite comic accurate. I mean, none more so than Deadpool, probably. So I think they could do it, but there's probably 99 ways they could do it wrong and one way they could do it right, if you know what I mean. So there's so many more ways that they could mess it up. But again, if X-Men ever does go into the MCU, I'd like to see them give a go to the original uniforms. If not, you know, exactly how they're drawn, just experiment around with it. And they've done it so many times now that I just trust them to do a good job.
Yeah, Yeah, and maybe that's what they might do with the reboot, Dave, if they do reboot them, especially with they're going to have to get a Wolverine at some point, aren't they? So
I'll give you an example where they've just ditched the comic book look. Actually, too, I guess Hawkeye, you know, now the comics look like he does in the movie universe, and Scarlet Witch, you know, so you can see there's a bit of an influence in the way they do her now. But if you see a costume from the comics, you know, she's got this headgear. It just would not translate well to screen.
Yeah, exactly.
I do think with Cyclops, with Wolverine, I think they could do it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's a shame because, like you said, you know far more characters than I do that could have been in this film. And again, budget constraints have sort of done that. And we've come across that on quite a few of these Marvel films, especially Deadpool, where they didn't believe in the project. But this was the flag bearer, Dave. This was the one. I've said it a few times in the podcast. That changed everything, I think, in some respects. Blade was a precursor. It was brilliant. And it's shown that you can get away with it. But this was the one. And everything's standing up at this point. There's a few nitpicks we've picked up on, but nothing that detracts from the fact that it's a good film, you know.
And
you know, and we get to Statue of Liberty, and we've got the big speech there, you know, which coincidentally is just across from the Statue of Liberty, where all the main sort of figureheads who've been against the mutants and things like that are there having a black tie dinner, aren't they? And I like this fight scene though, because we get like Mystique and that, don't we, where she turns into Wolverine and she goes against him, don't she? But they're not sure, the other X-Men, who's who, sort of thing. And I like all that. I like all that interaction with her. But she's actually got a bit of a thing for Logan, hasn't she, really? And it's more like she's playing with him than actually fighting him in some respects.
Yeah. I mean, in the comics, there's a bit of a history there. But some of the fight scenes here were really good, weren't they? And one that got played over and over again is where kind of Mystique's doing a kind of spinning midair kick, and she sort of transforms from Logan into Mystique just before she clocks him around the head. But yeah, again, it's another one where the Brotherhood are getting one over on the X-Men, isn't it? You know, you got Toad, he's kind of held up in midair by Jean Grey and then just spits out some mucus and basically suffocating her there. Toad also, he takes out Storm, doesn't he? Throws her down an elevator shaft.
Yeah.
And like you say, for a little while, Mystique's keeping Logan going.
Yeah.
Giving as good as she gets.
It is, when this is all going on, this is more of a distraction because, you know, Magneto's got Rogue there and he's tied her up on it at the top of the Statue of Liberty, which is quite a convenient position to put her in, one of the most iconic statues in the world. You know, you're not doing it by halves. You're not doing it in a little cupboard somewhere or a little barn somewhere off. You're actually doing it probably one of the most focal points of Manhattan, aren't you? So, but it sets it for the film and we get all these battles going on and then they go to try and get Magneto, and then he sort of gets them all again, doesn't he, and encases all of them. So Scott ends up...
Sorry, just before that. So Joss Whedon actually wrote an early version of the script for this movie.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of lines that live on. One, I think, is great, because we've just touched on it there. So when Mystique's there, and Cyclops and that, they see there's two Logans fighting each other, you know. So when they see Logan again, you know, they're like, well, prove it. Prove it's really you. And he just says, you're a male reproductive organ.
Yeah, to Scott. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Scott.
Yeah. And he's like, all right, that's a Joss Whedon line.
Yeah.
So that's the good one. The awful, and it was the delivery as well of the line that worked so well. The other one is, it just grates on me so much, is when Storm and Toad are battling.
Yeah.
And she tries to send him off into the water, and he's got his tongue wrapped around the barrier there, and she says, "Do you know what happens to a toad when it's hit by lightning?"
I know.
And you're thinking, oh, there's going to be a cracking burn coming up here. Same thing as everything else. She laid it up so well, and then it's just, oh, that is such a weak, terrible, terrible line. But I believe, and again, the fact that it is a Whedon line, I believe it was supposed to be delivered in a, it was written to be delivered in kind of a jokey way. You know, like, same as everything else. You know, something like that. But Halle Berry was adamant it had to be delivered seriously. And I think it's just awful.
Yeah, it's a bad bit of dialogue, isn't it? Yeah.
It is.
I mean, she doesn't really have much range, does she, to her acting, I suppose. She's a pretty lady, but I wouldn't say this. Well, in other films, yes, but in this, she isn't. She's not really.
I was going to say, I've seen her be good in other stuff, but in this, I mean, it could have been anyone. And you know, she doesn't pull off a Kenyan accent particularly in this one. And so she ended up ditching it. You know, she just goes with a normal accent for the rest of the movies. But yeah, so yeah, not great in these ones.
No.
But yeah.
Sorry, Dave, go on. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, so getting back to, before I went back to that tangent there, you were saying that he's got them all strapped up in the little bowl sort of thing in the Statue of Liberty there.
Yeah, Scott's got his glasses took off. He's took them away. Wolverine's pinned against the wall again, and he looks at Wolverine, doesn't he, and like, you know, he's pointing them claws, you know, somewhere useful, and he crosses his arms on it, so they're into his chest sort of thing, and he's trying his hardest for not to reveal, and it's good. But then you get that weird thing again with Sabretooth comes over to Storm, doesn't he, and then he's like, I owe you a scar, and I'm like, oh, right, okay.
Isn't it, you owe me a scream?
Oh, a scream, is it? I thought it was a scar, yeah, that's how memorable it was.
So when they were in the train station, and he's got her by the throat.
Oh, he says scream, doesn't he? Yeah.
Yeah,
you're right, Dave. Sorry, yeah. My mistake there. But yeah. So we get a nice little scene where I like it, where Magneto leaves them all tied up and, you know, with the metal and stuff, and he goes up to Rogue, and he's obviously got to transfer his powers to her, and to get the machine to work. So he's obviously at a weakened state. And, you know, he sets all this off in motion, and then the precursor is the X-Men are all sort of imprisoned, but then Logan thinks, right, you know, we've got to do something, and he decides, which is the whole point of crossing his eyes, decides to basically pull his claws on himself, which then detaches him from this metal that's encased him. And then we know then that there's going to be a bit of a battle going on, and he ends up having a fight then, doesn't he, straight away with Sabretooth at the top of the Empire State, and they're still like Cyclops and Jean are still all obviously encased, and this goes on, the battles are back and forth, and then they end up back down, don't they, and that's what Sabretooth says to her, doesn't he, you're right, I've gone a bit far ahead before, you know, you owe me a scream. And then he says, doesn't he, does his famous line, I haven't finished with you, bub. He always says bub, doesn't he, which I love. And then he says to Jean, he looks and throws up Scott's glass, and she says, look, when I say open your eyes, and he's like, no, and he said, yeah, open, and he throws him over, and she goes, right, and then he blasts, doesn't he, Sabretooth through the Statue of Liberty, and he just goes flying down, and he's out of the game then, he just takes a boat out as well, he's a yacht that's gone.
Yeah, and I like it when they're using their powers in conjunction with each other, so, you know, they're kind of teaming up, and I like the way Jean kind of used, you know, Logan had obviously he got free and whatever. And again, I thought that was a fairly heroic moment. He's still got to stab himself through the chest, you know, to try and get away. But, you know, the fact that Jean's then using her telekinesis to bring the visor up and using Cyclops' optic blast to take out Sabretooth, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was really good, really good. And, you know, it has to be that way. And it solidifies Wolverine as like the main superhero, really, of this film, doesn't it? Because he'd go at any length to want to save Rogue, and to fight what he believes in. This is where you're getting that sort of moral conscience coming into his character more and more as the film goes on. That loner side is obviously something that he doesn't like, but he believes he has to because of his powers and the way he's been ostracized by sort of the whole of the people he interacts with over time. So I like it. I like his character development in this one.
Yeah. So he's the one, you know, they have a bit of dialogue, don't they? Again, the team's coming together without Professor X about what are they going to do to take, you know, to try and rescue Rogue. And, you know, they basically say, look, throw Wolverine up there. And he's saying, well, you know, if I fail, you can still blast it anyway. So you've still got a plan B there. And you see, you know, he's on the top of this little machine there, drops down. Magneto's still there. He's still got a bit of juice, hasn't he? And when he's bending Wolverine's claws, maybe that bit didn't stand up perfectly. You know, just how it looked. It looked a little bit cartoony. But in the end, you know, Cyclops does take the shot, doesn't he? He takes out Eric, knocks him out. So Wolverine can actually take out the machine with his claws. And fortunately, you know, it doesn't injure anyone. It just sort of all breaks apart. And then this wave of radiation that was about to, you know, turn all these humans into mutants, or it just dissipates, doesn't it? So they've saved the day there.
And yeah, then exactly.
I'd kind of forgot about this end bit that obviously I remembered that Rogue did survive, but I'd forgot that, you know, he tries to touch her skin, doesn't he? So she can take some of his healing powers. And then you just see that kind of grief in his face. He's like, oh no, nothing's happening. You know, she's obviously dead. I thought it was a real touching little moment there. That to be honest, I'd kind of forgotten about.
Yeah. And it was nice. It's nice. And again, you know, he's saving her, any sort of thing. He's saving her because, you know, she's dead basically, isn't she, if she doesn't do it. So, no, good. There's three times that happens in the film, but each time they don't waste it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. But after a few seconds, then you see his kind of veins start popping out and you know, he is having the powers taken away from him. I thought it was an odd choice to have, like, the cuts start to appear on him again.
Yeah.
You know, because he's already healed. It was just odd. I don't think they do that in any of the other movies, but again, I'd kind of forgotten about that bit, but I just thought it was an odd choice. It's obviously just to show that he's in a weakened state. So he's basically been this invulnerable guy before, but now he is very vulnerable.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, we've got all this, everyone's saved, you know, the thing's not gone off. It's basically dissipated, like you say, in the water. So, you know, all the humans or non-mutants are gone. And then, we go back then, don't we, to after all this has happened, he's Professor X and Wolverine are sort of, you know, back on, well, Professor X is never going to be back on his feet, so that's a poor choice of words. But
doesn't he say a Hugh Jackman improvised line? When Wolverine's first being introduced to, like, Cyclops, to Storm and whatever, he says, what do they call you, Wheels? Apparently that was a Hugh Jackman improvisation. The script called for him to say Baldy, which wouldn't have aged quite as well. So I thought that was a good little line there. But yeah, so I mean, it's the wrap up, isn't it? So he's sort of saying to him about this little place up in Canada, you know, so he's been digging around in his mind and stuff. And so it's a nice little lead onto when we get to X-Men 2. And, you know, so basically at the end of this movie, Wolverine's going to head off up north to Canada and try and find out a little bit more about his past. So the very last scene, and this is the days before end credits, isn't it? So I think this might have been an end credits scene if it was done today.
I thought this little scene was perfect. Just the playing chess, you know, Eric's agitation that he's in there, but he's sort of still cocky, saying, you know, this plastic prison won't hold me. Thought the you know, the idea of the plastic prison and the little plastic chess pieces, I thought was brilliant. And you know, but Charles obviously goes about things in a very different way, but you know, he's still utterly firm in his beliefs, isn't he? So Eric's saying, you know, there's a war coming and you know, I'm going to be there to fight it, and Xavier's sort of saying, yep, and I'll be there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought it was a really nice way to just wrap up the movie there.
Yeah, it was, and you know, we've picked a few things out there, but yeah, good film, Dave, good film, and solidifies my being that Wolverine is still the man and always will be.
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant.
So should we go to our wrap up? So I think I mentioned earlier, I saw this when it came out in the cinema, absolutely loved it. For me, this is absolutely a seminal movie.
Yeah.
You know, before this, so we talked about Blade, and obviously that was important. But in terms of mainstream comic book characters and the serious tone that was set right from that first scene in Auschwitz, I just thought it was done really, really well. Now, I've seen this movie tens of times, probably not like Star Wars and Superman, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times, but at least tens of times. But I haven't watched it for a few years now. And again, it's one of those, it's 18 years old now. I'm kind of thinking, well, how's it going to hold up? And was pleasantly surprised, you know, apart from a few little bits. You know, I mentioned about Wolverine's claws popping out and some of the CGI doesn't look quite great. But actually, considering it's 18 years old, I think it stands up pretty well. I think in the middle of the movie, I thought it got a little bit dull. Like you say, we picked on a few things. The fact that he's just got this magic machine that just turns people into mutants. I didn't love that bit, but overall, I think it stands up really, really well. And so I'm going to send this one to Atlantis.
Good stuff.
Not quite an Asgard, you know, but a very strong Atlantis.
No, good stuff, Dave. Good stuff. I don't think I'm too far away from you there. I think Hugh Jackman makes the film as an undiscovered sort of Hollywood star, and his first one, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. The whole rage thing, I absolutely love. Like I say, it across people like the Incredible Hulk and even the Goody Two Shoes Superman when he gets his, you know, his backup sort of thing. I love all that, you know, that thing where they could just go absolutely maniacal if they need to in some respects. And
Which Superman? Do you mean Superman 3, where he goes a bit?
Yeah, yeah. That sort of rage that they had, that inner rage which they're trying to control. But I just love the he doesn't give a damn Logan. I just love all that, and it goes through every film, and that's one of the reasons I always stuck with the X-Men and Wolverine, and even like I say, the much maligned Wolverine origin film, I actually really like it, to be fair. And I know a lot don't. They sort of, like, even in Deadpool, he changes that timeline himself, doesn't he? You know, but and I think at the end of it, the Deadpool at the end, Ryan Reynolds is terrible. But anyway, Hugh Jackman just sells Wolverine to me. And yeah, there's a few daft things go on, and I agree with you. I think there is a bit of a slowness to it that it felt a bit, in some respects, is they were just filling scenes out just because the budget. You know, there was an end bit where obviously all the budget's gone on that CGI and at the start, and there's a couple of other bits like the train scene, very important CGI bits. But I do understand what you mean. There's probably some the stuff between him and Scott's good, but really some of the stuff between him and Jean's a bit, I don't know, a bit poor in some respects, because Wolverine's his sort of anti-hero in some respects. But also, they're making him out to be like this sort of adulterer and stuff, aren't they? Where he will, if he gets chance, he'll run off with Jean. So that never really sticks with me very well.
I mean, in the comics, he is madly in love with Jean.
Yeah.
It's one of those tragic things. It'll never happen. I mean, again, you know, he is a fairly tragic character.
Yeah.
And so, I thought they did an okay job. It didn't sell me, to be honest. It was a little bit too soon, wasn't it? Which
yeah.
is why I think you're saying about the, you know, he's like an adulterer or something. He basically, he's just met her and then has fallen for her pretty much straight away, so...
Yeah, and I know they always say that Florence Nightingale effect, don't they? Where you know patients fall in love with the nurses because they're they're getting them back on the feet and everything. But this, like I say, it was a bit too. And I don't think there's a lot of good chemistry between them. There's a lot of scenes where they're very close to each other and that. But I wouldn't say the chemistry is electric or anything. It's just functional, yeah. I think, for the film. So that always has a sticking point with me. And you know, Ian McKellen, Magneto, absolutely fantastic. He's probably the shining light with Hugh Jackman again, because in each film he's so strong. Even in X3 and the whole Juggernaut situation and all that, he's still a great character, you know. And you see a bit more of a human thing as we get into them films. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So I'll give it an Atlantis as well, Dave. And not because there's anything too wrong, but Avengers has just set the bar so far ahead. This was a flag bearer for all of them. The gateway into what we see now, and people should embrace it, but it's just not an Asgard, I don't think.
Very good. And you know what? If we were in a time machine, well, a time machine wouldn't work, but if we had this little scale back in 2000, this would go straight to Asgard.
Yes, totally agree.
And you know what? The X-Men franchise, the movies, they do have their problems.
Yeah.
And especially when you get to like X3 and Wolverine Origins and whatever. But those first two movies, I think, were incredibly strong. And I think some of the hate that gets directed towards the X movies, I've seen all sorts because I'm on a lot of X-Men groups and things. And there's a lot of hate for these movies. But I think people are retrospectively, they're looking at what the Marvel movies have become.
Yeah.
And they're kind of looking jealously and saying, oh, the X-Men, if they were only handled by Marvel, they'd be better. So I think people have downgraded their opinions on X-Men 1 and 2, to be quite honest, because of what the Marvel movies have done later. But I still think that those first two movies were great.
Oh, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I totally agree. And it's going to be good for us, Dave, especially X2, because I think I saw it about 18 months ago. So it'll be interesting to review that at some point in the next few months, just to see, because that's always renowned as the best of the lot, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we'll go through the, you know, each franchise that we pick, we'll kind of go through in order. So, you know, we'll do X2 next, we'll do X3. I think Wolverine Origins is the one after that, I think. But actually, I think a lot of people like X-Men First Class, probably more than X2.
Yeah, oh, that's a good film. I've got that on Blu-ray.
It'll be interesting. As we're going through the reviews, if you was hold a gun to my head and ask me now, I would probably say First Class was my favourite.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen X2 for quite a few years, so let's see. I mean, let's see where it gets sent to when we get to them in the reviews.
Brilliant, Dave. Absolutely brilliant. So, Dave, another week, another podcast. Have we got any selfless plugs you want to throw in there?
I have two football-themed selfless plugs. So the first one I've got is the Grassroots Coachcast. So if you're interested in coaching football or soccer at the youth level, get on across there and give that a listen. Myself and my co-host there, we just talk about a different subject each week and talk about our experiences, both good and bad, and basically try and give any advice as well for other people who are in similar situations to us. The other one, of course, is our newer venture, which is the Chat Footy Gossip podcast, which is a very different podcast. I'm not quite sure after editing how long this one will be, but it's definitely a lot shorter than this one, isn't it? So if you're still with us, you know, these ones are nice bite-sized daily chunks. So usually kind of less than 5 minutes, aren't they? And usually just to try and wrap up all that top footy gossip. So we tend to center around the English Premiership, but then we do talk about gossip from the other leagues and other countries as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it's been an eye-opener for both of us, because seeing it from a more neutral perspective as well. You know, that's the news, isn't it? We can't report on our respective teams all the time, and you end up going further away from that, don't you? Because you're trying to prove your neutrality as well with these things. But what a great thing we've got into here. The researching and the news reporting, and total respect, we're doing it on an entry sort of basic level, aren't we? That them guys on Sky and that we found that when we're doing this, obviously we can edit this and you guys get the final edited version, but to actually produce something for 5 minutes solid and be professional, concise and not make a mistake is hard work.
Yeah, and especially with a lot of the foreign names.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you know, you're reading it and in your head is slightly, with some of these, like, you know, Eastern European names in particular, and you're just trying to read it and speak it out in a quite short, concise manner. Yeah, you're right. I mean, we both tripped over our words a few times there, haven't we?
Did you hear mine today? I did one today where, obviously, we sort of cherry-picked what news we're going to do, and there was a story from Southampton releasing two players, and the second one I nearly suck out because of... I'm not going to be able to pronounce it. And I actually say, I think I just said that wrong. Yeah. Because I literally was thinking, how the heck am I going to say this? He's like four words just tripped off my tongue. And I'm thinking, I don't think any of them even was the correct way to pronounce it. But yeah, it's good. And total respect to anybody who does this as a full-time living, because it's really difficult. We all think we can do it, but you simply can't. There's a real... brain to, like, the way you've got to read stuff's unbelievable, and I've got total respect for them guys and girls.
Yeah, absolutely. So Chris, any selfless plugs from you?
Just my usual contextual podcast. We were supposed to be recording today. Yeah, so I'd had a few technical problems today. The software that I use to stream is called OBS, Open Broadcast Software. And there's two versions of it. One of them is called Streamlabs Open Broadcast. And they keep updating because Streamlabs Open Broadcast is in beta. So they're updating, and sometimes it's working, sometimes it's not. So everybody's been having problems with it. So I think for this weekend's recording, I'm going old school and doing what we're doing here and just going on YouTube and then dragging the audio from there, because it's just going to create more problems than it's worth, I think. But yeah, stick around. It's available on Twitter at cpod78. And the email address is thecontextualpodcast@gmail.com. And then on iTunes, SoundCloud, it's Contextual Podcast. Please give me a follow, like, subscribe, turn the notifications on.
Excellent. And we will let you know as well, as we're actually approaching the World Cup, aren't we? So we're going to have to actually start arranging when are we going to get everyone together and do a little preview show for the World Cup, just so we can get everyone on there. We need a schedule, who's going to do what games. We're not commentating on it or anything, but you know, come the end of the day, we'll want something to talk about. So hopefully we don't all get on and say, I was at work today, I didn't see anything.
So
So there may be another podcast out there.
Which we will promote, obviously, within this and all our other podcasts on the Whatever Network, Dave.
Yep. So all the podcasts that we've spoken about, including anything on YouTube as well, is all part of the Whatever Entertainment Network. And if you're interested in doing your own podcasts and you're interested in being part of this network, then just reach out to us and let us know.
Yep. Yeah, and we'll help you get things up off the ground if you need any help. Myself and Dave are veterans now of the podcast, as we're both known as the podcast kings within our friends group. So,
are we?
Well, yeah. Yeah, the podcast kings. I've been told that a few times. Not just me, you as well, because you're popping up on all mine as well. So,
yeah. Podcast curse something.
Yeah. Means with a C. But no, we will. We had to start and learning from scratch, and we know the pitfalls of how to get these things off the ground. So, if you guys want any help or anything, please get in contact with us. You know, because we want to help you guys grow as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you do want to email the show, you can get us where, Chris?
The Gmail account, Dave, is comicsinmotionpodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter @comicsinmotionp. Please give us a shout. We both police both them accounts, so whoever you send it through, so one of us will pick up the messages. Right, Dave, so another great episode. I've been Chris Phelps. I'm going to hand you over to my co-host and good friend, Mr. Dave Horrocks.
See you later, bub. Why do you ask questions before it begins?
Don't you people ever die!
You know what happens to a toad when it's struck by lightning? Same thing that happens to everything else.
You must be Wolverine. Remarkable metal doesn't run through your entire body.
Doesn't it ever wake you in the middle of the night? The feeling that someday they will pass that foolish law, or one just like it, and come for you and your children. It does indeed.
What do you do when you wake up to that?
I feel a great swell of pity for the poor soul who comes to that school looking for trouble.